Today is Wednesday, July 2nd, 2008. This is Susan Resnick, continuing with the oral history of Dr. Shirley Nash Weber. Good morning.
Good morning.
Tell me a little bit more about the community in San Diego. You mentioned it yesterday, and I'd like to hear more.
Well, I think, you know, one of the unique things of being in Africana Studies at San Diego State University is the fact, unlike many other departments, you know, being involved in the community, having connections to the African American community was expected not only of the university to a certain extent, but most importantly from the people who lived in those communities. They saw Africana Studies as their resource and connection to the university. So immediately that put us in a position of needing to be involved in the San Diego community and figuring out what it was, where it was, and those kinds of things. It was kind of interesting because, as oftentimes, there are faculty who don't like that. They've come to the university with a clear perspective that they're faculty and that their task is to do research and teach classes, and they're not into being, quote, involved in community. And we had a number of people who came in and out of the department at various times who didn't see that as their task or their job or their responsibility. You know, I always felt very strongly that it was my responsibility, whether I'd been in Africana Studies or not, to have some outreach, because I live with the principle that to whom much is given, much is required, and that I had been very fortunate and blessed in my life, not only with parents and other kinds of things, despite all the economic and social challenges that I faced, that that I had a responsibility to give back. You know, I always say my mother had this philosophy in life called the open hand philosophy. She'd always say, you know, you leave your hand open to give. And in that process, yeah, you might drop something, kind of like having coins in your hand, you might drop something. But if you keep your hand open as you give, you're also open and receptive to receive. And so you'll always get as much, if not more, back than you actually gave. So I operated with that particular principle of that. The San Diego community was very interesting when I came to San Diego, coming from Los Angeles, because, one, I was accustomed to a much larger African-American community. I was accustomed to a community that was larger in percentage and more concentrated in terms of where people lived. What I found here in San Diego was that, one, it was a smaller population. It was about 7 or 8% in terms of the total population. And, two, that there really weren't really large pockets of African Americans living in any particular place. There were once upon a time large areas, communities developed like Emerald Hills, which still has what probably the largest pocket of African Americans in terms of residential homes. But also Valencia Park was a place where new homes were being built and the up-and-coming kind of progressive African Americans lived. But once integration came in and once people began to work to integrate in Claremont and El Cajon and Del Cerro and other kinds of areas such as that, housing integration came, those communities became less African Americans in terms of large percentages and more diverse. It's interesting, even now in 2008, because I still relatively are strongly involved in schools, that there's really only one elementary school African that's predominantly African American, which sounds really strange. Some have 30%, 20%, but Johnson Elementary continues to be the one elementary school, I think, that has over 70% of its student population African American. And it's a small school of 500, 600, 700 kids. It's not a very big elementary school, but it's located in the Emerald Hills area and has a long tradition of excellent education, a long tradition of generations of young people going there, so that people who went there years ago, now their children go there and their grandparents still live in the neighborhood of Emerald Hills. So it's an unusual community. It's also unusual because it's not always a very open community. That's the thing that's also very interesting. It's almost like a little town. Oftentimes tell people, when I first came to San Diego in 1972 to look for a place to stay, I was with wasn't my fiancé at the time, but my fiancé, who became eventually my husband, brought me to San Diego to meet some of his friends who were lawyers here in San Diego. And at that time, there probably was in 72, there might have been 4 or 5 black lawyers in all of San Diego. So I think I met them all at once. It's kind of interesting. Yeah. But we came to San Diego, and it was interesting because we were being shown around by some guy, and to look for me to look for an apartment. And this guy began to tell me all the gossip of San Diego. He told me different famous people, supposedly famous, who were cheating on their wives, who were having children out of wedlock, who were, you know, all kinds of things. And I was just kind of blown away because in Los Angeles, you know, you seldom hear that, only because there's no way in the world you'd ever meet these people. You know, so why tell you about Joe Blow, knowing that you would never, ever meet Joe Blow? In Los Angeles, you could move from one block to the next and start a whole new lifestyle, having been a mass murderer two blocks away, and no one would care, probably, and no one would even know. So I get this information, I'm thinking, this is really crazy. I would never meet these people. In less than 6 months, I must have met everybody that this person talked about, which says to me, this is a really small town. This is a very parochial kind of setting. These are people who, you know, everybody knows everybody. And so it's really, really interesting that I did that. But it was an eye-opener to me that this is a different kind of community. This is a very small community, a few people doing lots of things, most people not doing a whole lot of things, and that it's a kind of community that is also very protective of its people. It's those who live here who are real, quote, San Diegans feel somehow or another that they're under attack from the outsiders. And they're not as open and receptive to outsiders. So the Los Angeles was like, there were a number of people from Los Angeles who came to San Diego thinking, okay, this is a hick town. I can make it big. I'm a small fish in a big pond in L.A., but here I'm a giant. I'm a whale. And I could really, really take over this little town and run it. And the people in San Diego were very resistant to that. Mm-hmm. They were very resistant to this outside slick person coming in who's going to slick them out of everything. So it was a community that was interesting for me and trying to figure out how do I make a difference, given the fact that my whole life had been involved in communities. I had done, you know, had a sense of involvement. My mother did, my family did, of believing that you have to give back, that you have to work. And then I'm on a campus that demands, in my mind, a sense of community involvement. But it was really quite interesting. But then I realized that the difference for me would be that I was not here on a temporary basis. Initially, I thought I would be, but as I San Diego became my home, I realized, okay, I'm here for the distance. I'm the distant runner. I'm not the sprinter, and so I'm not running through San Diego, you know, trying to snatch what I could get very quickly. I'm here to create a better world in San Diego, and I firmly believe that. And I believe that my name was my bond. That there's nothing better than a good name. That honesty, honor, truth, those kinds of things was what I was raised on, what I lived by, and that would mean something. So for me, you know, being involved in the community was significant, and really taking my time with that involvement. So it's a lot of times people say, how'd you get so, you know, involved and so recognized in the San Diego community? I said, my God, I've been here over 35 years now, and it's not like an overnight experience or a quick love affair. This is a lifelong experience, and so I recognized that and became involved in San Diego, beginning small, really, in my church. And recognizing that there were a number of individuals there who were, and I've always gone to what people call the non-educated church. You know, in my church, Church of Christ, there are always these you know, high class churches where you have everybody with a degree, and then you have the everyday people who go to church at another congregation. I've always gone to the everyday church because I always found the people there more genuine, more giving, more receptive. I found them looking at me initially like, okay, this is one of them smart kids. But then learning very quickly that, yeah, I'm smart, have lots of skills, but I'm willing to give you my skills. If you need me to write something, organize something for you, you know, you can be the leader, I can be the worker bee. And so I found myself joining quilting groups because I want to learn to quilt, and that's where I got to know all the old ladies in the church and got the, and so when I eventually had children, they were the ones who embraced me and my children. I joined a quilting group. We sat around, I mean, old-time quilt that we had, like the sawhorse kind, not with the sewing machine. And ladies would make the tops, and then we'd put the batting on and roll it up. They showed me how to do all this stuff, and we'd sit around on Tuesday night, I think it was, drinking coffee and cookies and sewing on top of this quilt. Right. So I learned how to quilt from these older ladies, which I thought was really quite exciting. But more importantly, I learned a lot about San Diego simply by listening to what they were about, how long they'd been there, what the city was like, what the values were, you know, those kinds of things that were central and important. And that was important to me to know San Diego. Diego much more than just to do the data and the statistics, but really to know the people of San Diego. And I found being at that quilting group gave me a wonderful opportunity to talk to women who were, you know, much older than myself, 30, 40 years older than me, but yet able to share with me in a very a simple way and a very concerned way their love for San Diego, their love for their families, their love for what they were doing and how important it was. They obviously became very proud of me because, you know, here I was. At the time, I didn't have my PhD, but in that process, I got my PhD, and they felt a part of that process that was there. Out of that grew a number of organizations. I mean, we began working because we were quilting. It's like, what are we going to do with these quilts? So I decided that because I had been where I came from, Los Angeles, we worked on Christian education. And there was a college, a black college in Terrell, Texas that our church is a part of that I actually serve on the board for now. I began to say, well, why don't we raffle these quilts and give the money to this college? So every month they had this breakfast. We had this little breakfast, and we would raffle these quilts, and we would sell the tickets for $1 and raffle the quilt, maybe make $100, $150 a month. And it was a nice way of giving back, of teaching them how to give back in a bigger way than they'd ever thought of before, because they had not thought of, you know, participating in a national thing to educate young people around the nation. So we did this, and it was really kind of funny because the lady who did the quilts, Miss B. B. Presley was her name, wonderful woman, still alive. She was the one who really put the quilts together and wrapped them up and did a lot of the hard work for us before we got there to sew. It was almost like, you know, she's the luckiest woman in the world because almost every breakfast, she won the ticket. She won the quilt. And so she would say, well, you guys keep it. That way I won't have to work so hard next month to make a new quilt. And so it was always interesting that she did that. Out of that also grew, we hooked into a national group called the Ladies Auxiliary for Christian Education, called LACE. And we then began to participate in LACE activities with them and established a little club, and women had membership in it to send to Southwestern College. And then we began to offer to organize these huge dinners, 500 and 600 people who sold tickets, who came to this dinner, and we raised thousands of money to send to this college. So it was really kind of an empowering experience and expansion for these women who had never believed in their minds that this would be something that they would do at such a grand scale. Mm-hmm. I was privileged because they allowed me to work with them, to take them to that level, you know, to help them to organize. And they were, you know, they were just excited as could be every year. For about 10 or 15 years, we gave this dinner and sent money to Southwestern Christian College. So I think as a result of that, I was eventually invited and recently have joined the executive board of the Southwestern Christian College in Terrell, Texas, to represent the nation in terms of education and opportunity. But out of that experience of working with that large community came a lot of involvement with other kinds of communities that were there, because once you begin to do things like that, and my connection with the university, which always gave me a platform, I think, to provide expertise, to support to agencies and organizations and people in trouble and people trying to get into university and workshops on how to improve their kids' education and those kinds of things, you know, it opened up an opportunity for me to go into so many different directions. That opportunity, as well as by then I had gotten married in 1973 to Daniel Weber, who became an attorney and eventually a state judge. I became involved in lawyers' wives' kinds of activities. Mm-hmm. You know, you get involved, and my husband and my kids always say, you always have to start something, Mom. You know, you can never just come in and take it in its rawest form. And I thought, well, you're absolutely correct. I'm not gonna argue about my life and my past at this point. I'm too old to do that. But so we started the Lawyers' Wives organization, and it was interesting because we started giving scholarships to individuals who wanted to be lawyers. And I got a chance to meet a lot of the lawyers' wives because it was a small group of us, maybe about 10 or 15 lawyers at the time. Mm-hmm. And we started doing scholarship activities. We started doing a Halloween thing called the Spooks Ball, which was really quite interesting. And it was in Balboa Park, where everybody came dressed in costumes and to raise money for scholarship and those kinds of things. So I became involved in that and went to a lot of the national conventions for the lawyers' wives and did my little thing at that level. But out of that also came my interest in something I'd read about in the Union Tribune that had to do with battered women's and battered women's services. Ashley Walker Hooper was the director of a facility that had been opened at the downtown YWCA, and it dealt with battered women. And so she came to campus and did a lecture for us once, and it was really revealing. She was an African-American woman in this area where really the center kind of catered more to white women, because black women didn't get into so much an exposure of batteredness, because, you know, the image of us is that we're supposed to handle our business, in essence. So we're being beat up by a man, we're supposed to beat him up first. I mean, it's, you know, this whole image of black women, you know, that carries over into everything else. And so we didn't have a lot of people coming in, but Ashley was a wonderful advocate and an educator on this area. So it was interesting to me. So as a result, I said to the lawyers' wives, I said, you know, we must help this project because this black woman is involved in it, and somehow or another it may have some impact in our community. So the lawyers' wives began to every holiday to adopt the battered women's services. We would figure out what they needed. We would take down, you know, clothing for children. We give money. We had the room painted to decorate for the children to look nice at the Y, and those kinds of things. And as a result of that, when Ashley then finally really institutionalized Battered Women's Services, she called me and said, you know, I really need you on my board. And I thought that was kind of interesting. And I thought, well, I don't want to be on another board. I'm fine. No, I really need you on there for a host of reasons. And so I served on Battered Women's Services board. And I found it very rewarding because it really was, at that time in the early 80s, it was really on the cutting edge of looking at what was happening to women that had not been revealed at the time, that the, you know, the whole idea that it's not her fault and we need to educate women about that, that women don't have to go back to their husbands and those kinds of things. And so I've always had a special passion about the battered women's services and what it does, and looking at it over time, because eventually many years later, maybe 10 years later, of course, I served on the board of the Y, mainly because of my involvement with battered women's services and my commitment to the YWCA and keeping that facility and special sheltered facility for women who were in crisis, and meeting so many women who didn't have home support, family support to do those things. And that was so, I mean, you know, as I've been at the university, every experience emphasizes to me in some very bizarre way how truly blessed I've been in my life, you know, that that if I had been a person who was being battered, that I think my sisters and my brothers would have come to my rescue. I know that my parents would have supported me. Yeah. You know, those kinds of things. And you look at people who you say, well, did you tell your, oh, yeah, but they said, you know, I need to stay with him, or, you know, and coming out of a situation where I had a mother who had been abused in 19, you know, back in the 1930s and 40s by her first husband, and saying there's no way to side of heaven or hell, I'm going to accept this. And she leaves in 1939, 1940. I mean, this is unique in terms of women, or my grandmother. So, you know, this whole idea of me as a woman having some control over my existence, I'd realized at that point how truly blessed I was that I had as a part of my psychic and my personality, right, that I was not going to tolerate the level of abuse that these women had tolerated. So it was really, you know, an eye-opener for me to see this at Battered Women's Services. But out of that, you know, it led me into so many different directions. I probably have lectured for every organization in San Diego, literally, and sometimes more than once, so that if it's an organization that needs a speaker or something of that nature, they know they can call me. If I'm available, I will do it. I do that for my church, even though I may charge universities ridiculous rates. I don't charge churches. In fact, I've got 3 women's seminars to do this year in Los Angeles, in Atlanta, and in Tennessee, and I've already done a couple this year, because I really believe that if I have a message, or if I have something to give, that I can give to change the lives of women, to change the lives of those who are less fortunate, then it's my responsibility to give it. It costs me very little to do that, other than to be there, and they'll pay me to fly. They pay my airfare to get there, and I will do that, because if it changes someone's life, or if it enhances an organization, makes it stronger, better, more productive, because they can advertise that I'm coming to lecture, hey, and that's what I'm supposed to do. That's what life is all about. So my life in the city was really involved in providing resources and services and support for women organizations, for the Urban League, the NAACP, you know, the ACLU, you know, all those organizations I've been recognized, awarded for my service to all of them, and I saw that as something that you do. I always tell people I operate on the premise that anytime I enter a room, the world ought to be better. Now, I believe that. Not that I think that I'm such a powerful person, but I firmly believe that each one of us has a unique ability to change the world in which we exist. And if you don't use that, then who are you? What are you? Why are you? I mean, you know, what's your role in this world? So if I'm on a board, it's going to be a better board. If I'm at a school, it's going to be a better school. Mm-hmm. When I put my kids in Encanto Elementary School, I said, it's going to be a better school. Mm-hmm. Why? Because Shirley Weber's here. And I'm a parent. I'm an involved parent. I'm going to make the parents better. Right. I'm going to make the teachers better. It's going to be a better school. And it was while I was there, the 6 years I was there. I just firmly believe that we have this power within us that That's most right. of us deny that will that can transform any place where we are if we choose to. You know, and regardless of the obstacle, and it doesn't have to be a huge transformation, but I just figured that my spot on this world ought to be better. So when I enter a board, I enter a board trying to figure out what can I do that's different? Mm-hmm. You know, what can I bring that's unique? I think boards are made up of real diverse people. Mm-hmm. And you ought to release that diversity wherever you are, and that you bring a unique perspective. And if I don't understand your world, it's you ought to explain your world to me so I can understand it, so I can understand where you're coming from, so that I make better decisions because I now know what kind of world you live in and where you come from. So I like I said, I participated in an awful lot of things. So it was interesting to me that in 1987, I got this phone call from Miss Thelma Pryor, and Thelma says, "Shirley, we had a meeting." I said, "Who in the heck is we?"
Yeah.
Well, it was George Walker Smith and Dorothy Smith and I think one other guy and somebody else. About four or five people met at this church. They said, "We had a meeting." This was in the summer of 87. "And we've decided that you should run for the school board." Dorothy's decided she's not going to run for re-election, and we've decided we had a meeting and made this decision. My response was, "I am confident that there is someone else who can run for the school board, and we just need to find them and support them, you know, that there are some good people out there, and this will happen." Mm-hmm. "Well, we've made this decision, so we want you to talk it over with your family, discuss it, and we'll and get back to us." I said, "Fine." So my husband came home, and I told him, and he said, "Well, you know, because he had tried about 4 years earlier to get me to run for state assembly, but, you know, my kids were small. I'm not going anywhere." So I said, "Oh, no, I can't do that. That's impossible." And so he says, "Well, you really should." And I thought, no. And I left it alone. So when I told him about the school board, he says, "Well, I've been trying to get you to run for stuff for the longest, so you really should run." And I'm thinking, this is insane. So I figured, well, if I don't call them back, they'll go away. You know, like anything. That's my theory sometimes about illness. If you don't pay attention to it, you get well, you know, that kind of thing. So I didn't call him back. And so maybe about 4 months later, Thelma calls me again and said, "You know, you really didn't call us back. So we're assuming that you run in, da-da-da-da." I said, "I really hadn't thought about it, Thelma. I said, I just assumed that you guys had found someone else." She said, "No, we have found you. This is it." And then she proceeded to tell me things I had said in speeches in the past about responsibility, about, you know, taking charge, while when your time is up, it's like your call, you got to respond. So this woman is quoting me about responsibility on the phone, and I'm thinking, oh my God, the chickens have come home to roost. You know, all this stuff I've been talking now is knocking at my door.
Yeah.
I thought, okay. So I said, "Well, you know, Thelma, I'm in the middle of my career at the university, blah, 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 blah." She said, "Yeah, I understand all of that, Shirley, but we really need somebody to take the helm now. Dorothy is retiring," so forth and so on. I thought, oh my God. And there's nobody we trust to advocate for us like you. So I said, okay. I thought about it. I said, okay. My husband says fine, you know, so forth and so on. We'll move forward. Little did I know what I was getting into. But I told him at the time, I said, "But understand this. You know, I'm a professor at the university, and I love what I do. This is going to have a profound impact on my career, what I'm doing. It's almost like putting my research, my life on hold." I said, "But I will do it for 2 terms. And in the end of 8 years, I'm out." Okay. And I said, and I firmly believe that. And I'm glad I made that statement early on, because I think after 8 years, you really have burned out. You've done some things, and people can understand why I would leave in 8 years, because I was being very effective. But I discovered at the end of 8 years, you stop. You become the system rather than an advocate for children. You become an advocate for the system. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing, nobody needs another advocate for the system or the school board. Mm-hmm. We need an advocate for children. Mm-hmm. And so I said, okay. I learned a lot in the campaigning. Wow, did I learn a lot, because I had no idea what campaigns were about. I was kind of involved in terms of my husband would have fundraisers at the house. We'd give money, and I'd go away. You know, somebody called me, I might go do a little phone banking, but I really had no idea of what happens at the large level of politics, campaign managers, the things that take place. And, you know, in San Diego City Schools is a large school district because it's second largest in California, seventh in the nation. So being on the school board is a tremendous responsibility. So I had no idea all the campaign stuff that happened. But I was telling someone, I learned something that was really unique because in the process of this whole campaign thing, I learned that there's a whole nother world out there that makes decisions that my community knows very little about. I often refer to being black in America as not being in having a glass ceiling, mm-hmm. but a steel ceiling. And yeah. I said the value of a glass ceiling is that I can see what's upstairs. I know there's another room. Mm-hmm. I can even read lips and maybe figure out what to do. Mm-hmm. But when there's a steel ceiling, I think I'm at the top and I don't even know that I'm in the middle mm-hmm. or even at the bottom. Mm-hmm. I have no idea that there's another room up there. I don't know even who's in that room mm-hmm. or the conversation they have. So when I entered politics, I entered that steel room. It was really, I mean, I went inside, I finally saw politics, I saw people, decision makers. I got to meet an awful lot of people, and I learned why people make decisions that they make. I mean, and I think it's an eye-opener for people in our community that don't understand politics, don't understand why they don't get what they want mm-hmm. out of it because of the voting patterns and all those other kinds of things that you don't think about.
Yeah.
In terms of politics. So it was an interesting experience for me to run a school board race because San Diego Schools District, not only do you run in the district in which you represent, but you run citywide. So no matter how well I did, I was running as two people in the primaries, and there were three of us. I got 60% of the vote and still had to run citywide against a woman who got 19%. So in the end, I ran citywide. I got more votes than the president. I may have been Ronald Reagan, whoever it was. I got more votes in the county than the president got. But I won by 80% of the vote, you know, and yeah. And that's, you know, that, you know, but it's always funny. I tell people, you know, you leave a campaign and you're riding high because nobody gets 80% of the vote. Yeah. I got 80% of the vote, and immediately somebody calls and tells you that they didn't vote for you or something of that nature. So, you know, your ego gets shot real quick, or people come out and tell you they hate they voted for you or whatever it is, and reality sets in real quick when you become a member of the school board. But I became a member of the school board in 1988. I was sworn in 1988, and was the only African American on the board. They've never had more than one person of color on the board from the time that I've known. I think now they may have two. But I was the only African American on the school board, and I think everything I learned as a student at the university, as a community servant, as all those kinds of things really came to bear on my role in the school board. Mm-hmm. I had learned a lot about people, about the community, about how to work with individuals, how to get what you need when you're really in the minority, and I was very much into not crying the race story, but really talking about how to be successful mm-hmm. As a school board member. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it was very, very important when I became a member of the school board that I represent my district as well as children in the community
right.
across the board, that that my standards of excellence and expectations would be basically permeate the district and people would know what I stood for. So I immediately became involved in learning everything I could about San Diego City Schools. And I got to know also every board member quite well. Fortunately, I had campaigned with Susan Davis, who's now a congresswoman, and Ann Armstrong, who was running for school board at the time and from La Jolla. And because we were on the campaign trail together, because Susan was up for re-election and Ann Armstrong was running at the time, we got a chance to know each other really well, to form a relationship and a friendship, so that I got a chance to peep into their world and to know what they were made of. Because I thought that was very important mm-hmm. to understand what people do. Ann and I became very good friends. It was really funny. I always tell people she's my only friend I've ever known who puts butter on her sandwiches. You know, she would make a sandwich, she would butter the bread, then she'd put mayonnaise, and then she'd put the meat. And I'm thinking, why waste good butter on bread? I mean, it was the weirdest thing, but then I learned Ann's father was a doctor, and so she was somewhat affluent. Mm-hmm. And I laugh, I tell you, the only friend I have who wastes good butter on a sandwich. I said, when I was a kid, And we had butter. We made butter and sugar sandwiches, you know, because that became a sandwich in itself.
Mm-hmm.
We were not about to waste good butter to hold together sandwiches. And she says, well, it makes the sandwich hold together good. I said, well, if you pour, that sandwich is not going to drop anyway. So you got a good grip on this sandwich. So the last thing you need is some mayonnaise. Or the last thing you need is butter. You just need some mayonnaise and some meat, and you can hold that sandwich mm-hmm. yourself. So it was kind of, we always had this running funny thing with her making these sandwiches. But I learned a lot about Ann and Susan, and then eventually I learned a lot about the other members of the board who were on the board with us. I was fortunate to be on the time when Jim Roach was there, who was one of the sheriff, who eventually became sheriff. And I remember Jim called me one day and said, you know, I want to go to breakfast with you. And I said, fine. So we went to breakfast, and I got a chance to know who he was. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you sit at a table with people, and if you don't really know where they've been right. or what they the shoes they've walked in and the, yeah. and the journey they've had, you can't understand why they make decisions. And so the good thing for me was that in listening to him, I got a chance to know that he was a kid who basically almost dropped out of high school, you know, stole a car, ran away. I mean, this is his life story that he tells everybody. And so I really got a chance to know that this was not just the guy who lived in the Scripps Ranch area, mm-hmm. you know, who now is, you know, a major player in the sheriff department or what have you. But this is a person who understands young people, who understands them because he was one of them once upon a time. So he and I became very good friends. So I had an opportunity to meet on a personal level the members of the school board and, mm-hmm. and made that a part of my role as a board member so they would know me and know where I was coming from and the kind of experience in life that I had that was so very, very important and why I made decisions based on my experience. I remember once when we were debating something about employment with people who worked in cafeterias, and someone made a really disparaging comment about the competencies or the intellectual prowess of people who worked in cafeterias. And I remember stopping the meeting and saying very clearly, my mother was a cafeteria yeah. worker at my elementary school, and she was not a mindless individual. She was thoughtful and sincere and dedicated mm-hmm. in everything she did. Mm-hmm. And everybody stopped because this was something that nobody else's mother had done. But my mother was a cafeteria worker part-time right. in my kid's school, at my school, excuse me. And so it becomes important for us to know where people come from. But when I was on the school board, it was a real challenging and wonderful time because I had the unique opportunity of working with Tom Pazon, who I consider to be one of the best superintendents, and his deputy superintendent with Bertha Pendleton, who also became eventually a superintendent. But Bertha was a woman of tremendous integrity. And I learned a lot from Tom, I think, as a leader, and as I look at superintendents since then, Tom had certain qualities that were really important as a superintendent that built a school board that could function. And one of the things he did was he never gave you information that he didn't give to everybody. He was not in the business of empowering one board member against another. So if I said, Tom, I'd like to get some data on what the achievement level is for kids in a certain day, he said, no problem. And he'd tell you everybody, I'm going to give everybody the same thing. And he'd make sure we all had the information. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't walk into the room with a set of stuff to bang somebody across the head with. And so we knew that. He was a very honest and open person. When he made mistakes, he let us know that. And no decision against him was ever grounds for him to hold it against you in the future. So if we were debating issue A and he wanted us to go a certain direction and we rejected that direction and went another direction, when we got to decision B, totally different discussion.
Mm-hmm.
He was not about to get back at board members. He was not about to become vindictive. And so he really set an atmosphere for us as board members as how to operate. So that if I'm on a board, every now and then I remember once we were fighting about something really, really, and I was adamant about it. And I was upset with the members of the board who were going to go against this thing for poor kids. And, you know, and I understand their position. And we fought, and I mean, I argued hard, and I lost, okay? Susan and I lost, okay? That was fine. So Ann is sitting there looking at me scared because she says, because we're scheduled to go to lunch the next day. She goes, are we still going to lunch? I said, we're going, and you are paying. And so we both fell out laughing. She says, gladly. You know, it's one of those kind of things. But we operated at that level, that there was a level of integrity, honesty, no underhandedness. We respected each other. And I think it came from the top. It came from Pazon, who respected board members. It came from Pendleton, who respected board members. And really gave us a way to operate as a board. when I was a student at UCLA, one of the things in the speech department that I discovered became very valuable to me is that I had to take an entire quarter on parliamentary law. And I learned parliamentary procedure backwards and forwards. And, you know, I do workshops all over the nation, and I've trained the local leaders program here, all the folks in parliamentary procedure. And at the time when I took it, I thought, what a waste of my time, you know, what a waste. But it turned out to be a very, very significant piece of my life because being on boards, being able to understand parliamentary procedure, those kinds of things, and it's an invaluable tool to basically not only to help people, but to move the agenda and to move things forward. And I've never operated on the premise that, my knowledge of parliamentary procedure should alienate people or to make people angry because I'm tying up the meetings and all these procedures. But it is designed, hopefully, to make things flow a lot easier, keep us focused, keep us on task and moving forward. Because of my personal commitment to achievement with kids, and understanding that, you know, that if you're poor, as I say to them, you're going to have to run faster and jump higher. You're going to have to know a whole lot because your mother and father cannot will you the company. You're going to have to build your own company. That I went on the board believing that every kid had to have high high expectations, high achievement, that we had to bring the best that we had into children in the district. One of the things that happened as soon as I got on the board was that we got data concerning African American males. And I think the first year I was on the board, about 30 African American males in the whole, or less than 30, I guess, in the whole senior class in San Diego City Schools, which was about 100 and some odd thousand, 130,000 kids, only 30 some of them had a B or better grade point average. We had tremendous failure among African American males. And it wasn't just us, it was nationwide. So one of the good things about this board is that Tom was forever having his staff do research to reveal our problems. You know, sometimes school boards cover up the underachievement and a failure and a dropout and all that other stuff. We were not into that. We were, and oftentimes you'd get criticized, you know, you guys, the schools are failing, but I mean, at least you know where you are. So we then implemented a special program called the Improving the Achievement of African American Males, the IAAM program, and it became a really a national program for how to work with African American males. And one of the things that we did, which was really quite unique, we advertised for mentors to run this program. Pupil advocates is what we called them, and to work with this young people, this population. And we had certain requirements, which was really quite unique, and it proved to be so wonderful. We wanted men who were successful academically, but who had not forgotten who they were, because we didn't want kids to say, "Yeah, he might be smart, but who wants to be a nerd?" Who wants to be like him? We had to have guys who were cool, who could walk and talk with the kids, but who had been academically successful and who could relate to them. So we advertised for this job, and we had something like 180 applicants for these four positions. We were amazed, first of all, that there were so many men in San Diego who wanted to work with kids, who were police officers, social workers, who had gone into different careers, even some in banking, who had gone into different careers and all of a sudden decided they want to come back.
That's great.
So we ended up selecting these four men who became our pupil advocates. The beauty of them is three of them were my former students who are now back in the career. You know, it was kind of interesting because as the board was praising these four men that we had hired, they were, these were the most fabulous four men they could ever find anywhere who really developed a marvelous program and who really did wonderful works with our kids. It was interesting because when they introduced them to the board and then we saw them all, it was kind of funny because they said, "Dr. Webb, do you know any of these men?" And I go, "Well, I've had him as a student and him as a student and him as a student, and he has been a mentor to that." And they go, "You know these people?" And they said, "Oh, yes, Dr. Werber taught us well," and it was really kind of funny, but it was as you know, as an educator, it's always very rewarding to have your own students come back in this capacity. But that organization, that Males Project, still exists in city schools. In many ways, they've unfortunately dismantled it and weakened it by trying to give them too much responsibility. But we saw with them, and then I worked with the Urban League to develop the Golden Pyramid Scholars. Because what we wanted to do was develop a culture that says excellence is acceptable. Excellence is what is cool. And so we then began to work with those pupil advocates at the four schools. They were at four different schools in the city that had large populations of black males. and looking at curriculum and working with teachers and working with kids and working with parents. And so we then ended up with the Golden Pyramid, with the Urban League, doing something called the Golden Pyramid Scholars, so that every year the number of black males who had a B or better average began to grow. And these kids, if they had their grade point average, a B or better, and then accumulated the next year and the next year, they would come to a luncheon that was sponsored by the Urban League and Hewlett-Packard. They would get a pyramid, a golden pyramid, to hang around their neck. So these kids were proud that they could wear their golden pyramid. And then they would, then as they began to graduate, they were getting scholarships. And so we ended up at the end with several hundred kids at this luncheon every year celebrating the Golden Pyramids. A friend of mine, former student too, Jackie Jackson, who was education director of the Urban League, she actually organized this program and to complement our efforts in San Diego City Schools. So we began to talk about achievement and what kids need to do. I remember going to I think I may have been at the point vice president of the board or something, and I went to our first meeting of the board where we give out awards and honors. And I stood there and I noticed that all the honors, we at that time, any student with a 4.0 was valedictorian. We didn't say just one. You have 4.0, you could have five valedictorians at your school. We didn't care. We want to honor excellence. And so we looked around, and I looked through this audience, and I'm handing out these wonderful awards and recognition, and not one is given to an African-American, and not one is given to a Hispanic kid. So I'm devastated. I'm devastated. I said, okay. So I went and started talking at that moment to my ninth grade students. And we had this huge conference, and I said, I need to see valedictorians. Mm-hmm. I need excellence. I need you people to get 4.0s. And they go, oh, my God. I said, no. If you aim for a 4.0, you will get a 4.0. Mm-hmm. Take some AP classes that give you more than 4.0, give you 5.0. I went through this whole thing. Everywhere I went, I was talking, I need to see valedictorians in the senior class.
Terrific.
I just went on and on and on. And in about 4 years, when I did the valedictorian things, there were black kids and Hispanic kids who were valedictorian. One at this school, two at this school, three. I said, you know, you have got to set your sights higher than what you have before.
Yeah.
And so we began to see these students with some goals. Because I would go to the schools and talk to the senior class, and I'd say, you know, the ninth graders, this is what I need. This is what I want to see. I mean, I need to see that in you. I said, do you know how it feels to be an African-American who stands up in front of this board? I'm president of the board. I'm passing out these awards. And I don't give a one to anybody who looks like me.
Mm-hmm.
All the other kids are very deserving, and I'm happy to give it to them. But I got to have somebody. You got to commit to me that you're going to do this. And the kids was like, what? I said, no, that's too hard. I said, no, you have got to do this for me. If you don't do it for yourself, do it for me. You know?
Yeah.
And so I would go through this big thing. And so we ended up start seeing these kids really saying, okay, I think we can do it. And two and three of them in a class getting 4.0s or 4.1s and 4.2s. Because I said, if other kids can do it, you can do it. You know, we've got to have some of that. And we began to see Hispanic and African-American kids aiming for high expectations, doing those kinds of things, wanting to be on teams such as the Academic Decathlon and the Constitution Committee that went to Washington, D.C. We had kids who were Westinghouse scholars. You know, and sure, we had kids who were struggling, but I'm saying to them, we've also got to have examples of excellence in every community so the kids know they can be successful, that they can achieve, that they can accomplish these particular goals, because it's important that they do. Interestingly enough, because, you know, when you're on a board and you're the only African American on the board, almost every time something happened, it would be like Ann and Shirley, Susan and Shirley, you know, John and Shirley, but it was always Shirley, because you're an urban school district. You're an urban school district where the population is shifting from once where it was 75% white and 25% people of color back in the 1970s. But I'm faced with the reality in the 1990s that is now 25% white and 70% people of color. Complete shift on the scale. So clearly the issues of urban education and kids of color is central. And when you begin to interact, at least San Diego City Schools begins to interact on a national level, it has to have somebody, you know, you're going to send a representative, you're going to send probably a representative of somebody of color. So I end up going to a number of things with Payson, which led me into different directions in terms of a national level. Because we were involved in restructuring schools and trying to empower parents and develop a parent involvement policy and a curriculum for parent involvement organizations and those kinds of things, we began to look at our standards and what we do for kids. And so we got a call to come to New York to participate in something called the National Alliance for Restructuring Schools. It was a part of a Rockefeller Foundation, and you know, we were slated to get, which we did, get a $4 or $5 million grant to talk about how to help schools to restructure. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting because I went, and a couple other board members went, and Tom. And then when they said to Tom, you got to have one of your members of your board, and preferably the one of color, you know, because, you know, we want to diversify. Because, you know, around the table, too, were other school districts that had no African-Americans on their boards, no people of color. And so when I went to the National Alliance for Restructuring Schools, I think I was the only person of color on the board. I mean, it was that kind of thing. And so I became the National Alliance vice president, and there were a number of school districts at the table. Interestingly enough, who was also at the table was Arkansas, and who was representing Arkansas was Hillary Clinton. So Hillary and I, Hillary was on the National Alliance for Restructuring Schools, and Arkansas was undergoing a process of changing its schools because it had such poor schools, and I mean, teachers were paid. I mean, I met a woman who came to an alliance meeting who said something to the effect, she was a statewide, like assistant superintendent or something. She might have made $18,000 a year. Now this was in the this was in like 1990, okay? This is ridiculous. So she was saying, you know, when you come there, you have to have other consulting jobs and things like that. I thought, why? I never heard of such. And of course, I think the governor at the time made about $20,000 or $30,000 bill in 1990. I mean, it was really poverty in Arkansas. Arkansas did not pay their people. And of course, I'm being born, having been born in Arkansas, born in Hope, Arkansas, where Bill was born, and him knowing somewhat of my family, I discovered later on. Hillary was on our commission and doing school reform. And the interesting thing is that when we got ready to have one of our meetings, we were requested to come to Little Rock. To come to Little Rock because they were in the midst of some transformation of standards and expectations of kids and trying to standardize the curriculum throughout the state of Arkansas, because these little enclaves of little one-room schoolhouses or whatever they had weren't in sync. And so they were trying to improve that curriculum for the farmers and everybody else that was in those very rural areas. So we actually went to Little Rock and stayed at the Peabody Hotel, where the ducks walk every day.
Yes.
And so we went to Little Rock and had a chance to be there to meet with some of the people to kind of lend support and lobby those efforts in Little Rock. But the beauty of it, we also went to the governor's mansion and had a chance to meet with Bill at the time, and he was governor. And it was funny because Hillary had told him, there is this woman from Hope I've never met. She told him, I've never met anybody from Hope on any national commission before. So here's a woman born in Hope that you have to meet. So he came in. It was really an interesting thing. We went to the governor's mansion, and it was weird to me because, you know, Arkansas is still Arkansas. I mean, I'm from Arkansas. It's still Arkansas. It had no gates around the mansion. We drive down the street, and at the end of the cul-de-sac is the governor's mansion. I mean, it's not like it's guarded and armed.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
You know, it's just like it had a big grass, so therefore we knew we were at the governor's mansion. Nice house, and it was interesting swings in the back or whatever for Chelsea at the time. But it was really funny because, and the ex-convicts served the food and you know, work in the governor's mansion. And we had and one of the things we had, one of Bill's favorite food, which was absolutely wonderful, was catfish. And it was the first time I ever had catfish appetizers in any kind of uppity event.
Uh-huh.
But these guys had the best fresh catfish they had cut in tiny little nuggets on toothpicks that they had deep fried, cornmeal fried catfish. It was absolutely wonderful. And so, I mean, it was just absolutely delicious. That was delicious. But the National Alliance, I worked with the National Alliance, and then eventually out of that we developed something called the New Standards Project that got involved in the development of standards for how to assess schools and those kinds of things. So I, as a result of my involvement with the school board, I became involved at the national level with doing that. One of the other things we did on school board that I considered to be important that eventually carried over to other things was that when I first got on the school board, we were talking about building schools, new schools, mm-hmm. in areas, and that we were really overcrowded and near Balboa School, Hispanic School. We had all these multi-track school, which means you take a school for 900 and you put 1,200 kids in it. You put them on different tracks, and one teacher never had a classroom, so she'd roam from room to room every track period, and then she'd be off on the fourth track. So it was really a crazy system that I didn't like. And I committed myself when I got on the board to eliminate multi-track schools, and I did. But and when we're talking about building schools, it was once again the view of the world based on politics, of people's perception of old politics. It was like, okay, we can't build new schools in poor neighborhoods because people north of 8 won't vote for them because of the fact it's south of 8. And that's not a voting population, and they're not going to increase their taxes, the whole bit. On the premise that when you build schools anywhere where there's a need and you improve the quality of education for children, you improve the quality of life for San Diego. So I got the board to agree to build schools in old neighborhoods with low voter population. And we put a ballot measure together that won. And I think schools like Rosa Parks School, the Kimbrough School, Balboa, the change in Balboa, the Cesar Chavez School, all those schools were slated to be built, and they were all being built in poor and old neighborhoods. And it was kind of groundbreaking in a way, because eventually when the board went out for a new initiative, a new ballot measure, they targeted those neighborhoods. And we built, of course, a school in Scripps Ranch that was very needed, a middle school, Thurgood Marshall Middle School, those kinds of schools. But I said, you can't just ignore the reality of what you need in inner cities. Mm-hmm. And you're going to revitalize the community. I said, but I told them, I believe I can sell this and we can sell this to San Diego. That San Diego has to be bigger than its parochial view of the world. Mm-hmm. That it has to look for all the children, because I told them, I said, because kids nowadays, they don't just rob in their neighborhoods, they rob all over the city because they can drive and transportation allows that. So if you're going to change your life, you better change all of San Diego. You better change it all. I told them, I said, I walked through Rancho Santa Fe, we went to a retreat up there. I said, they've got more security in Rancho Santa Fe than they have in Southeast San Diego. So somebody's robbing somebody in Rancho Santa Fe. So, they should be concerned about the quality of education for everyone. So we were able to get an initiative passed that people didn't think we would. Overwhelmingly a passed initiative to build schools in old neighborhoods. And I think in many ways, it revitalized those old neighborhoods, but it also gave San Diego a sense of ownership about its children, because we owned all the children. And that was my position. I remember once there was an outbreak of some activity around the Rodney King incident that happened at Pershing. I think it was at Pershing or one of the elementary schools north of 8. And my board member, Sue Braun, it was her school, and her parents were furious and they were upset. And Sue had to go to that meeting that night. When she looked up and I came to the meeting, and she was kind of surprised to a certain extent. But I told her, I said, Sue, if something's happening to the children here in this community, it happens to all the children. And there are kids who ride the bus who come to this school from my neighborhood. So I feel a sense of ownership for all the children. Yeah. And I'm not afraid of these parents. I'm not afraid of this community. And so I'm not going to let you stand here and take all the heat by yourself. I'm willing to come. So I actually showed up at the meeting. People were shocked, that I came to the meeting. Because, who wants to volunteer to jump in the fire? Hey, if there's a fire going on, let's put it out together. And so I kind of operated with that premise that my kids in my community were bused all over the city, and other people's kids were bused into my neighborhood for various reasons, and that you own it all. You own it all. And the only way you can ensure the excellence of anyone any one child is ensure the excellence of everyone. I used to always tell kids when I would talk to them, it was always kind of funny. I said, one of the reasons why I work so hard to give excellence to every kid and make sure all you guys can read, I said, it's because for some strange reason, my daughter is very, very brilliant. But she loves men who can't read. She loves you guys with these saggy pants, with this illiterate behavior. And so the only way I can guarantee that I will have a son-in-law who can read is that I have to make sure all of y'all can read, because you will not come to live with me. And they would all laugh. I said, but the reality is that's real. Yeah. You can't save one child and not try and you save your own and not save every child. That's reality. Yeah. So I used to tell it to all the kids. That's why I work so hard, because some of you may think you're going to marry my daughter and then think you're going to live with me, and that's not going to happen. Wonderful. So I got to make sure all you knuckleheads can read and are independent, so that when you decide you think you're going to marry my daughter, you can take care of her and y'all can take care of each other. So it's that kind of thing. But clearly the time I was on the school board was an exciting time. And it's funny, because people still talk about the good old days of 88 to 96. And it was interesting, because we also, Susan had been trying before I got on the board to get health clinics in San Diego City Schools and never could. And so when I came on the board and went to Sue and Ann Armstrong, one of the first things we did was to open a health clinic at Hoover High School. Mm-hmm. We had over 1,200 kids at Hoover going to the nurse every month with ear infections, eye problems, colds. Kids wake up in the morning, don't feel well. Mom says, go to school. Mm-hmm. Go to the nurse. you know. And I could tell them, and I could understand that, because, you know, being a poor kid in the projects, we didn't have health care. We had major medical, which meant if you just about got killed and got into a hospital, maybe my daddy's health insurance would pay for it. But I didn't have a pediatrician. Never saw a pediatrician. I went to the clinic a couple of times to get shots. But I never had a doctor's name that I knew until I became an adult. Mm-hmm. So I didn't have that. So for me, a Kaiser card is like gold. You know, you can go to the doctor for anything. And so I didn't have that luxury. So I could understand kids going into that inner city nursing office and needing health care. Mm-hmm. So, you know, people thought, oh, you're going to start Planned Parenthood, you're going to have birth control. Kids are going to get whatever they're going to get. But our concern was health care. So we basically implemented a health care program at Hoover High School. Highly controversial. I'm telling you, people who did not live in San Diego at all rode all night to get here from East County, North County, you name it. We had people coming, screaming and hollering about birth control and health care and the right of parents. Parents had a right not to have their kids do that. And it was interesting that the people in that community that was going to be affected, that school community, the Hoover community, was very much in favor of this health clinic. Because not only we had partnered with the Children's Hospital, so the kids who normally would get Medicare and Medicaid, it was going to be paid for. We had dental care there. We had eye care there. You know, we have, and it's still there. There's a clinic that we took an old auto shop, and we got a grant from, I think, from Children's Hospital to redevelop that whole area.
Yeah,
and made a wonderful clinic that's still there at Hoover High School for kids, and that was, you know, that was our and we wanted to do that because that was a growing thing. The kids are going to school for health care, but it was highly controversial.
What, I don't understand, what were they protesting about? I mean, it sounds like it's a great thing.
San Diego is very conservative, and so are communities. What happened is that no one wants, you know, the idea that kids would go to a health clinic, because there are some clinics that do dispense condoms and birth control.
Okay, so that's...
So the issue was that.
Okay.
Plus the issue was, is this really the role of a school to have health care? And they thought that kids might be getting advice about health care. I mean, you know, and a part of it also was the people who are into the abstinence-only curriculum for sex education. And so you have this core of individuals who are opposed to anything that might have, that they think may be in conflict with their own personal or religious views. So, you know, I mean, that was clear. But it was interesting to me because I could understand if parents were coming from that community protesting. But it was not. It was coming from outside. And I guess the thought was, well, if San Diego does one, they'll do two, they'll do three, and before you know it, it'll be in our neighborhood. But the Hoover community was Susan School, was very much in need of it because it was a very poor community. Lots of immigrants in that neighborhood, still is. And their access to health care was very limited. There were very few clinics in the neighborhood that they could access. And then at the same time, they were familiar with schools. Schools are the friendly place for people. Mm-hmm. Schools are places that people go for everything. I mean, you have people come to school asking all kinds of questions about how do I get this or how do I get that. So we were in the business of trying to make schools kind of, you know, if you're going to deal with the academic, you can't ignore the health issues.
Right.
You can't always ignore the social issues.
Right.
You don't want to deal with them, but you got to ignore them. Because even at one of my schools, at Hamilton Elementary School, we implemented a program that brought in about 10 different social service agencies into the school. Developed a facility, a set of bungalows, because what we discovered is that, you know, one mother's dealing with the housing authorities, probation, you know, child protective services, and she's running like a chicken with her head cut off, hitting all these agencies where if they were located at the school, she'd get better service, but also the agencies could coordinate what's going on.
Right.
Because if we've got a kid who's losing their housing, it's going to affect them in school because they're going to be in this school this month, and 3 months later they're in another school and another school. If mom and dad is dealing with issues of probation or child protective services, that's going to affect the kid and where they're in school and what they're doing. So we just discovered that trying to coordinate these agencies, and we put them in one school, and it worked out well for that particular school. So the school then could focus on the academic and not find the teachers and others frustrated with dealing with issues that they weren't qualified to deal with until they didn't even know they exist half the time. Mm-hmm. You know, they didn't even know this kid's brother just got killed, you know, unless somebody comes and tells them that. And then they may not have had the resources to deal with it. Or if they're looking at kids and wondering why our kids are going from this school to that school, they discover that this kid moves a lot because of housing issues, you know. And so how do you intervene to make sure they stay in one school? So that was a part of, we got heavily involved in a number of those things. Probably one of the most controversial issues I was in at the school board was the issue of the Boy Scouts. And the whole issue of discrimination against Boy Scout leaders. And that was really quite an interesting experience. What we had was, and it wasn't, you know, it was difficult to communicate the message to people, but it wasn't so much that the Boy Scouts were, that we were putting Boy Scouts out of the school. What happened was we allowed the Boy Scouts to come into our schools during the daytime and run a curriculum for kids in the school. And so there was instructional time being taken up by the scouts at certain schools. Not so much the after-school Boy Scout meetings. Well, the Boy Scouts of America said that no gay person could basically be a leader in the Boy Scouts. So this issue was brought to us as an issue of discrimination. And that was highly controversial because, I mean, it's like, you guys hate the Boy Scouts, this and that. To me, it was fairly simple. I mean, you know, we were a school that embraced the whole issue of diversity and equal opportunity. We were a school that had a policy of non-discrimination. We could not allow anyone to have access to our children who participated in discrimination, period. Mm-hmm. You know, and while I could tell them, I said, I'm not, when they were saying, well, you know, different ones would say, well, are you, know, I said, it has nothing to do with one's religion or one's point of view, whether you're favor or against homosexuality or anything, things like that. It has to do with discrimination and equal opportunity. Mm-hmm. And we can, you can have meetings after school, you can do whatever you want with your organization, but you can't be, you know, and you can't work in San Diego City schools and participate in discrimination. So it was a major, major issue in the San Diego community. I mean, a lot of my friends who didn't understand, are you in favor of homosexuality? I said, well, it really has nothing to do with that. It has nothing to do with that. I mean, I'm in favor of non-discrimination. Right. I said, and keep in mind, although I told people, I said, keep in mind, there was a time, particularly in Utah, when African Americans could not be scout leaders. And that was not that long ago.
Yeah, I bet.
And in terms of Utah and the Mormons, that they did not allow African Americans to be scout leaders, and they did not allow the integration of scout troops. Mm-hmm. I said, now, so I recognize the value in the work of the Boy Scouts, but also recognize some of the boogaboos in the beer and the history of the Boy Scouts, mm-hmm. like everybody else's history. So you have to, I said, you have to make up your mind. Either you're in favor of discrimination or you're not. I said, and when you're doing public policy, you have to have a public policy of non-discrimination. Mm-hmm. Now, what people do with their personal organization, their private time, their whatever, it's their business. And what they choose to do, if they want their kids involved or not involved, is something else. But that became a major issue, and it was kind of interesting because as a result of that, I think I became the grand marshal in the gay parade, I think it was, 1 year, and got their Friends of the Gay and Lesbian Community Award for my standing up for what I knew was right. I mean, and I told them, you have to give me an award. I'm not an advocate for one group or the other. I'm just saying that you can't discriminate.
Right.
Period. And I said, there are a lot of things in America that I disagree with, but I recognize the fact that I live in America, and everything doesn't have to fit into my world. You know, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And simply whether I accept it or reject it, it has nothing to do with that. It has everything to do with I live in America, and I want to always be free to either accept or reject something of my own without having others do it for me. Mm-hmm. And that's a part of it. I said, you know, one of the positives and negatives of living in a democracy is that you have to tolerate a whole lot of stuff that you don't accept or that may not fit in your world. I said, but, and somebody was talking, I said, well, you know, I learned it when I was a kid, you learn these philosophies that are strange. And I said, I learned when we were talking about freedom once and where does my freedom end? And a teacher says, my freedom ends where your nose begins. And so as long as you're not at my nose, you got your freedom, you know. And so I'm not going to make you do things and so forth and so on. So it's kind of interesting. But I served my 8 years on the school board. I found it to be 8 exciting and productive years. But I had said that I was going to do 4 years, 8 years, and that was it. People said, oh, no, we're in the midst of it. I said, but you know what had happened in 8 years? I said, when I first got on the school board, it's like you look at 10 doors of opportunity. And that first year, you hit every door there is. You bang it as hard as you can. Every now and then, one will open. but most of them don't. Next year, you go back and you bang those doors again. But after about 5 or 6 years, you say, you know, number 1, 2, 3, and 4 ain't never going to open. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe they're ready. But by now, you've decided that's not going to happen. And your enthusiasm, your energy, your drive, your determination is tainted by negative experiences, or you know too much. Mm-hmm. You can no longer be the wide-eyed optimist that the world can change.
Yeah.
And I think when you get to that point, and I see board members like that now who've been on the board for long periods of time, whose usefulness is past, and they would be better doing something else. So I decided, 8 years, that's it, I'm out of here. And I left. I'm with no regrets. I've continued to work with the schools. I work with the as the executive director for the Association of African American Educators, and we run a program here at San Diego State, an academy for effectively teaching African American children, where we attempt to retrain teachers on how to educate African American children.
Tell me more about that, because I know you've written about that, and I'd like you to elaborate more.
Well, what we did was we decided after, you know, we had gotten in a situation with the Association of African American Educators does lots of conferences and seminars. But I had said to them one time, because we had gotten to a point where we were, you know, banging our heads against the wall. We changed superintendents, and who was not always open and receptive to new things. And you find yourself always asking for stuff. And I said, you know what? We need to take our own destiny into our own hands. And instead of, once again, complaining, we need to basically become more proactive. Mm-hmm. So we said what we were going to do was we were going to basically put together an organization, an institute or an academy that focused on teaching teachers how to work with African American children. And so we got together, and Wendell Bass basically gave us a structure for the curriculum at the time. And John Brown, who was a member of the board of the Association of African American Educators, and we put this proposal together to run this institute. We decided we would run it, we would try to do it at San Diego State. Initially, the extended studies was not real enthused about it, because, you know, if it doesn't look like it's going to make a whole lot of money, they're not that enthused. So they weren't that enthused about it initially. But then what happened was they did become excited about the possibility of it once the School of Education became excited. At the time, Dean Minnows was here, and he was a former superintendent of schools, and he also recognized that the College of Education did very little in the area of education focused on educating African American children and other kids of color. So I had once again a former student who was working in the School of Ed and had gotten her doctorate, and she was running a teacher prep kind of program. And so she came to me, Yvette said, when I told her about what's going on, she says, I think you should meet with Dean Minnows. I know he would be very interested. I said, ah, she said, no, I'm serious. So she met with him, and so enough, she organized a meeting. We met with him. He was very enthused about it. He said, I want you to meet with the heads of all of my departments about it, because I'd like some of our teachers to take advantage of. So we then met with him and heads of his department, and we put together this institute to basically train teachers. And we've had a number of teachers who've finished the institute. We're in the process, and what it was nine classes the students had to take, and three field experiences. And they had classes on special education. They had classes on teaching reading to African American children, materials that could be used to be incorporated. They had classes on attitudes and perspective of high expectations. They had, you know, so we had nine different classes, and it's still listed in our extended studies program. We had nine different classes that people took. They were one unit classes. And then we had three classes that were experimental classes that they then would take the material and apply it and write a paper. We work with charter schools. We work with people in city schools. We work with folks in Spring Valley and the various districts around. And their teachers would sign up for these classes that are offered, and we tried to make them teacher friendly so that the classes would be offered like on Friday night and all day on Saturday, maybe come back another week or so and do another 8 hours, get those 16 hours in for mm-hmm. one unit of credit, and focus and do a couple of them during the year for teachers. So that was our focus at the time. We're currently now doing a little bit of that, but we're also now involved in working with the current institute on campus that is talking about transforming schools, urban transformation, school urban transformation, that is run by Joe Johnson here on San Diego State. And so we're on a committee with him, and our dean is involved in it, because what we're looking at is how we can, in San at in Africana studies enhance our curriculum to focus on schools as well. It was the institute, the academy that we run here on campus, is the only academy that is really run that is in conjunction with a community group, so that the Association of African American Educators actually own the academy. Mm-hmm. And Africana Studies works with them so that it becomes a collaboration between the educators in the community, San Diego Africana Studies, the School of Education, and San Diego State. So it's a kind of a unique relationship.
That's an interesting model.
Yeah, a very interesting model, very different kind of model, so that, you know, and sometimes it's cumbersome because it makes decision-making long, but
yeah.
But in the end, you get people to buy into it who are actively involved in it, and we've done some good work with it. We've celebrated some teachers who've been a part of it, and have graduated some teachers who've done well and seen transformation. Interestingly enough, the diamonds in the rough that I work with at Crawford High School, it came out of this academy, because one of the persons in the academy was Deborah Brown, a counselor at Crawford High School. And when she had to do a project based on how you're going to change and uplift kids and intervene, as a counselor, since she wasn't in the classroom, she began to ask herself, what can I do? So she then developed this organization called Diamonds in the Rough. And she began, as a result of the class, to work with the formation of this group. So now she has these kids at Crawford who, some of them who were in fighters and who had, you know, one young lady, she had one more fight, she was out of school, period. Since then, she's recently graduated, and she's going to go to community college in the fall. She had another one doing the same thing. This girl is graduating. She's going to be a student at San Diego State come September. So we've gotten several of the kids from Diamonds in the Rough who come here. They go with us to South Africa, then they come here to the university. And she serves as a mentor and a support to the kids and their parents, and meets with them regularly so that the kids know they have to pass classes, they get good grades. But in addition to that, they volunteer. Like during the Katrina incident, they volunteered and went down to package stuff up to give. They also attend our library class that we offer for the library. They have to come to that class so they have information. Mm-hmm. They volunteer at activities around the city so that if a group is doing something and they need help, the Diamonds in the Rough will come and help set up and help organize and help prepare for it. So she's teaching them the sense of that you have to give back, you have to, you know, contribute back to the community that you live in. You have to be a good citizen on campus. The kids stop fighting. They start intervening for other kids. Mm-hmm. They start being this good role model. Because, you know, she taught them strategies of what they needed to deal with and how they needed to see the world differently than what they currently have. So she's trying to open up the world for them that they didn't see before. In fact, one of the young ladies came to my house. It was funny because I have this new bowl in my bathroom. Looks like a punch bowl, but it's a sink, the new glass sink
that's in,
you know, a real upscale, beautiful bowl. When I built this house, I got to have me a glass bowl like everybody else. So I got this in the powder room, is this glass bowl. This young lady came to visit us once for a Kwanzaa celebration because Deborah brings them to this celebration. So they came to my house, and it was funny. She must have gone to the bathroom like five times. Every time I looked up, she was going into this bathroom. And when she left, she goes, I'm going to get me a glass bowl. I'm going to go to school so I can get me a glass bowl. So I thought, cool, it didn't cost that much, but, you know, great, get yourself a... So it was that kind of motivation that she kind of continues to try to provide the kids with. You know, look at the world, look at the whole world. Mm-hmm. See beyond your personal situation, your personal challenge with your family and those issues, and see the whole world. You know, there's a whole world out there that can be yours if you just spend your time focused on getting it. So I thought it was so funny when she said she's going to get her a glass bowl.
Great.
She's going to school because she's going to get her one of those glass bowls. I said, wonderful, wonderful. But my, you know, my experience, and like I said, I think my driving force, and I'm known in the community as a person who's really into education and politics as well. You know, my political world has led me to all kinds of things, so that, you know, now we're in the process of organizing for Obama and trying to hopefully see this as a transforming experience for not only San Diego, but help young people to understand politics. One of the things that happened when I ran for office the first time in 88, I had lots of students working on my campaign. Those people are still strong advocates for politics. I mean, they tell me now, oh, I went and phone banked, because they came and they did it, and they had no idea there was this world of politics that they could get involved in. So all of them now still do phone banking. They walk precincts. They they see how hard it is to get a vote. And so they said, you know, once you work to get a vote from a person, you never, ever take for granted your vote. You go to the polls and vote because you understand the process and all the work that goes into getting you there, you know. And so it's one of those things that I've continued to try to continue to educate our community that politics is important. I try to give them real specific examples of the value of it, because when you work in politics, you don't understand, before you work there, you don't understand certain things. Like I try to educate them about what a 5 out of 5 voter is, you know, that's important to them to understand. And they don't understand that. I said, you know, when you have to make decisions about who you're going to call, you always call your 5 out of 5. I said, that's the person who in the last 5 elections voted 5 times. That says they vote in presidentials, they vote in locals, they mm-hmm. vote in primaries, they're going to vote, they're going to the polls. I said, now, if you're 1 out of 5, you're going to be the last person I call. Because if something happens, if it rains, if you stump your toe, if you lose, you get mad at your boyfriend, you're not going to the polls. You're one of those kind of people that, it's not that important to you. I said, but when you're 5 out of 5, the whole world calls you.
Yeah.
The whole world knocks on your door, and the whole world wants to hear you. And so I said, so your goal in life is to be a 5 out of 5. What if I don't like the people? Be a 5 out of 5. Go anyway. Vote for yourself. You know, but be registered at that poll that says, this is a person who's going to go. I said, because in the end, when a politician has to decide who they're going to listen to, they're going to listen to 5 out of 5. Because they know no matter what, you will be there for them. The other person might, but might not. And so I try to help them understand the nature of politics, because without understanding that, you sit there and wonder why the politicians don't listen to you. You're not a 5 out of 5. Mm-hmm. You're not a person who's going to go to the poll no matter what. You know, you have to have a track record of that. So it's that kind of thing that becomes important in trying to educate communities about registration, about involvement, mm-hmm. about empowerment, and how you take yourself and make yourself, you know, maximize your power base in terms of achievement. So I've had a very, a wonderful relationship with my community in terms of serving on boards and commissions, and still continue to serve on an awful lot of things that sometimes I'm not interested in. Oftentimes I'll tell people, I can't serve on your board, but if you have something very specific that you'd like for me to do, mm-hmm. I will do that.
Mm-hmm.
I will help you in whatever that is. And that helps a lot of people. I said, you know, I'm on too many boards. I can't go to another meeting.
Yeah.
You know, I just recently got appointed, though, to the city's commission on equal opportunity. And it took a lot for them to convince me to be on this board. But it's a very necessary board, because it handles all contracts, whether vendors or construction in the city of San Diego.
Yeah.
And it's equal opportunity. And right now in San Diego, women and people of color almost get no contracts. And it's amazing. It's amazing. And there doesn't appear to be equal opportunity or even an interest in it. So we're fighting on this commission. I just recently got them to approve something, and it was really, once again, my parliamentary procedure paid off, because it was one of those situations where the industry did not want us to vote on this particular issue because it was dominated by men, and they already had their contracts. And so we pitter-pattered around for the longest, and finally, because we had a majority in the room, but the chair didn't know how to bring it to a conclusion. And so he was saying, well, next time we come with this, and I raised my hand, I said, Mr. Chair, are you assuming that we're not prepared to vote today?
Oh.
Because he said, oh, are you? He said, well, I didn't know. I said, well, what you need is a motion.
Uh-huh.
And he goes, yes, that's what I need. So I made this motion,
yeah,
and it passed.
Then
the guy who was opposed to it decided he was going, he says, well, he was complaining about it. And he says, well, you know what? I think you guys have done this, but I think I would like to move that even though you pass this, that we can only, that they need, people need to understand that number 1, 2, and 3 are not, you know, he went on with this thing. In other words, he was trying to weaken the motion. And I let him make his wonderful motion. At the end of it, I said, you know, I spent a grueling quarter at UCLA studying parliamentary procedure. And I've been a national officer, national parliamentarian on many organizations. And my memory serves me correctly. You can't make a motion concerning this matter. I said, because you were not on the prevailing side. And therefore, you cannot tie us up in motions that will invalidate this motion. And he was dumbfounded. And the attorneys behind me said, I think she's right. I said, I know I'm right. Uh-huh. And it was the funniest thing. The woman next to me was so funny. This woman who was a part of the organization, because they're good-hearted people, but they don't understand part of my procedure. She wrote me this note. I love you. But, you know, it was an effort to, and I was telling my son, I said, you know, you don't know where your knowledge is coming from. And when you study stuff, you have no idea you'll ever use it again. I said, when I studied all that stuff and all those rules, I'm like, oh, God, I'll never use this stuff. Uh-huh. I said, I've used it almost every day of my life. But it's one of those kind of things. So I'm on the commission, and it's an interesting commission because it has such a tremendous challenge. Because in the wake of Prop 209, where you can't do things specifically to help people of color, you're trying to structure programs that create opportunity. Mm. And it's not an easy task to do in Southern California and in San Diego.
Yeah.
So we're struggling with that. And I agreed, a friend of mine who's a longtime advocate talked to me forever, and so I'm the mayor's representative on the commission, and it's a unique position because I don't have, unlike some of the others in the room, I don't have a vested interest. I'm not a contractor. I don't do work with the city. I'm not a builder. I'm not any of that stuff. So I can pretty much not, you know, be pretty open about my feelings about the policies and the issues that are there and try to create opportunity for people. So, I mean, but like I said, there's always something in San Diego, whether I'm working with the CHUM program.
What is that?
That's the Community Health and University and Medicine is what it is. And what that is it's a program out of UCSD that supposedly works with children to try to get them in the sciences. And we've worked with over the years with them. We run sometimes a summer institute and a spring institute. And I got involved with it. A friend of mine, Park Treffs, is the coordinator. One of the most committed individuals I know, white male scientist, who's dedicated his whole life to making opportunities for kids of color. And gets a lot of flack. He's not the easiest person to work with. People always ask me, how do you work with Park? Well, you know, I think I could work with the devil if they're doing something good. That was my attitude. I don't get into it. And he's a good person because I try to look beyond whatever flaws I have, you have, and everybody else has and say, in the end, is it going to do something good? Okay, is it going to help some kids?
Right.
And he's totally committed. And then he was very committed to my children. My daughter, when she was in middle school, it was Park Treffs. Was her science mentor, and he got her into all kinds of science fairs and science awards, and he helped to structure her science fair projects. He got kids of color doing winning awards at the state at the county science fair, and all those kinds of things. And Park was, you know, he's such a humble person. And I can always tell stories of me holding my daughter by her back of her pants as she's hanging off the Bay of San Diego, scooping up the water, because she's doing this research on sea urchins. I don't know what the heck a sea urchin is.
Yeah,
you know, I have no idea what these sea urchins are, but Park has, these kids have a zillion projects on sea urchins and sex life of this and that and whatever in the bay. And here I am holding her with one hand as she's and holding on to the whole thing so we don't both fall in. And she's reaching in the bay, scooping up this water. She had to get a jug of water that has sea urchins in it. I don't know. And, you know, that kind of stuff. So, but nonetheless, it was an opening experience for her and all the fellowships and internships she's gotten. So he's a great guy. I mean, he has kids all over the world now who are into science because he took the time to work with them on their science fair projects when their teachers didn't want to work with them on science fair projects. He just wanted to teach classes and go home. They didn't want to do hands-on science. They didn't want to make science interesting in inner city schools. And Park has always worked in inner city schools, making that difference, working after school with kids, making sure they had the equipment they needed, the materials they needed to produce excellence.
That's wonderful.
And he does. He does a wonderful job. So we continue to work with the CHUM program. We're looking at now how to bring a CHUM program into the Somali community off of University and 54th Street. He's been working there with a number of groups. We're working with parent involvement. The Parent Institute is how we can help the Parent Institute develop a science curriculum to help parents understand the importance of science while we then work with the kids to help them so there's a marriage between the parents encouraging the kids and the kids doing the work. So Park has committed his life to this, and I really became, because he worked at the university and what have you, and I knew a lot of people at the university, I really became his hammer. You know, I was a person when all hell breaks loose, I'm going to go in and tell 15 people off and get him, you know, $2 more or something. So I became the person who didn't really care because I was already tenured, didn't care whether it was a provost or whomever at UCSD or anywhere that I was going to go in and advocate for children where he couldn't or whatever, but I was going to be the person to get the stuff done. So I became the heavy, basically, in this project. And I didn't mind because you have to have somebody who's going to do this for kids. And so I may not have been popular with people, and I didn't get invited to all the parties, but that's okay. They weren't serving good food anyway. And so it's just crackers and cheese. So, you know, and so as that, and to that extent, I became that. And so I continue to work with those particular issues in those areas of San Diego that are important to me.
Have you found over the years, as you were describing when you first came here, San Diego is such a kind of small town city. Has it changed very much, or do you still have that feeling?
It is still a small city. It is. It's amazing to me. Someone came up to my son the other day and asked him, "Did you know your mother's famous?" And he goes, he laughed. He said, "What am I supposed to say, Mom? Yes, no, whatever." He says, "Well, I do know one thing. We can't go anywhere where everybody doesn't know her." You know, it is a very small city, and when you do things in San Diego, you are. The good thing is that you are embraced by people. They know you, they embrace you, and in the San Diego community, Black community particularly, it's still a very small community. It's quite interesting. My brother was he used to own a service station in Los Angeles in Long Beach, mm-hmm. and it would always be funny. Somebody would come to the service station from San Diego, and they'd pull in, and he would get to talk. "Oh, you're from San Diego," because he loves it, chit chat, and he would go on, and he'd say to them, "I know you know my sister," and they go, "Yeah, right." And they keep serving gas, and he keeps saying, "I know you know my sister," and he said, and it would finally they go, "So who is your sister?" And then he'd say, "Shirley Weber," and they go, "Oh yeah, we all know Shirley, yeah, you know." And I tell them, I said, "This is a very small town." I said, if you do a few things in San Diego, people will know you. Yeah. They will recognize you somewhere, and they will know you because but the interesting thing over the years is even not only do they know you, but like I said, they appreciate you. I mean, I this weekend I was at a couple of things that were political, and I guess two or three people eventually came to me and said, in so many ways, "You know, I've never really met you, but I just want to let you know I appreciate you." Say, because every time I look up, you're on television at the school board, you're advocating for something for kids, you're taking our kids to South Africa, you're doing these things in Ghana, you've got schools that you've adopted there. You know, you're always doing something. And so, you know, so people come and say that, and I said, "Well, thank you, you know, it's my responsibility." "Yeah, I know that, but, you know, we really appreciate it." So, you know, there's a community that does appreciate what people do, that they feel like somebody who does it on the long distance, you know, that it's not just you did it today because you want to be seen, but you do it because it's a part of who you are. It's a part of the culture that you came out of. It's a part of your personality that you're going to give, and you're going to give regularly to that. And but it still is it's a very small community, very small. Some years ago, it was funny, I was telling someone, when my husband passed away in 2002, I told someone, "I'm sure I'll never marry again." They go, "Why?" I said, "Because everybody in San Diego knows me. Who would I marry? I mean, it'd be the funniest thing." I said, I don't think there's anybody new coming in the city. So I said, not that I'm interested in marriage at ever again, I don't think. But it was kind of funny because they would say, "Yeah, that would be strange. You know, who would you know in San Diego?" Because I think I probably know just about everybody in San Diego at some point, or in the Black community, and a significant number in the Hispanic community. But it is a small, small world that San Diego continues to be, even in the political world, whether it's the mayors and mm-hmm. the supervisors and all those kinds of people. You get to know them on a very personal level.
Right.
And so, where, you know, you could live in Los Angeles forever and never really see an elected official, or never even know a school board member, or any of those kinds of things, and know who they are. You have to be really in the know mm-hmm. to meet people in Los Angeles. And yet here, you know, they're everywhere.
Right.
You know, they're everyday people.
Right. Well, you raised your children in this community, and tell me a little bit about them.
You know, my kids are very interesting people. I always say that. My kids, first of all, I got married in 1973, as I said earlier, and I didn't have children until 1978, 5 years. I was trying to figure out, am I going to stay married or not? Oh, yeah, what the heck? Let's have some kids. So, you know, so we decided to have two kids. And I, you know, My first one was my daughter, who was born in 1978. And in fact, today, July 2nd, is her birthday. She's 30 years old. And Akilah, her name means intelligent. Akilah Faiza, intelligent and victorious. Mm-hmm. Says one who is intelligent will be victorious. And so she, the unique thing with my kids is they were really raised here at the university. Because when I had Akilah, I was a professor here at the university. In fact, I think the student newspaper, there was a black newspaper through the Black Communication Center that used to exist on campuses. Dr. Weber Learns Baby Talk, you know. So it was, you know, a little picture of her and me. And it was, so she was basically raised right here at the university. I mean, I think other than her normal babysitter who kept her every day during the day, all of her other sitters in the evenings were all former students. Who were part of my life, who were in and out of my homes and interacted with the kids. And so they had a unique experience of being here at the university, and I always thought that was such a rich experience because, you know, I had friends who worked in corporate America, and it's probably, I think my sister once tried to get me to leave to go work for Bank of America in some corporation communication area. And I always thought, I always took working at the university as a real blessing and a privilege because not only I got a chance to do what I loved, but also I got a chance to expose my children to education. And I got a chance to not be stressed as a parent. Mm-hmm. So that if my kid was sick and I needed to bring her to school, she came to school. If she needed to sit in the back of the classroom and color while I taught my class, she did. And if I need to go to meetings, my daughter's been to the Academic Senate when she was 2 years old because we had a very important agenda going on and her babysitter was sick. And so she came to Academic Senate and sat through 4 hours of the Academic Senate, fell asleep in somebody's lap, one of the faculty members, and because I needed to be in that Senate meeting that particular day. So they really walked this university backwards and forwards. That's probably why as they got older, they didn't want to come to university here because they've been here. They've been to this school. They need to go to another one. But that got me very, and being having kids really got me the most involved in schools because once my daughter entered, she went to Montessori school as elementary school, as a preschooler. But once she got into elementary school at Encanto, that's when I became very involved in understanding how schools operate. I wanted my kids to go to public schools. I wanted them to go to public schools in black communities. I wanted them to be in the neighborhood. And I wanted them to do that for a number of reasons. One, I wanted them to love the neighborhood that they lived in, to love the people who look like them. But I also felt very strongly what Malcolm had said, that, you know, if you keep taking the richness out of the milk, you end up with skim milk. Mm-hmm. That if you keep, as people who know what to do, who have education and training, if you keep running away from your community becomes bankrupt. Mm-hmm. And what you contribute to other people. And even though you can come work in a community, living in the community, you're going to make that community better because you know how to write to the mayor. You know how to write to city council. So Akilah entered Encanto, first of all, it was a school of 1,200 kids. You know, here's a little kid who's 5 years old. I'm thinking, oh, my God, my baby's in a school of 1,200. Well, she adapted to it better than I did because all she knew was her teacher and the other 20 kids, 25 kids in the classroom. She didn't know about 1,200. She didn't know about anything. She knew about her kindergarten teacher and her classroom, and she loved it. So it was fine with me. But I also got involved in the politics of the school. One of the things I discovered at her elementary school was that they had parent meetings at 12 o'clock on Thursdays. Now, this was a working class community. So who's coming to a parent meeting at 12 o'clock? Well, who was coming were the kids whose parents who were bused in from affluent communities who didn't work. So the parent committee, even though the school was predominantly people of color and poor, was basically populated by people who were from somewhere else. So when I first found it, I became very upset, and the principal says, well, that's what the parents have decided. I said, okay, I'll fix this. So the next semester, I organized my classes so that on Thursdays at 12 o'clock, I didn't have class. So that I could go to the parent meeting and then move the parent meetings tonight, you know, one of those kind of things. And I got really involved in trying to help the school set standards because beyond what they had accepted, getting the school involved in other kinds of activities. And that's when I discovered this whole thing of multi-tracking and all these kids being stuffed in one school. And my school fought it, mm-hmm. and we won. I organized the parents. We went to the school board. We fought it, and Encanto never went multi-track. Mm-hmm. I fought it. And I became a board member while I was in Encanto. But the interesting thing is my daughter, who went to all these meetings with me, it was kind of interesting, she became president of her school. and she was president when she was a senior, but she became president of the sixth grade class, too. So it was funny, her principal had me laughing. She said, because Akilah had gone upstairs and she'd done something that evening on the computer, typed some stuff, you know, her little typing, and got some things done. So she went to school the next morning and she went into the principal's office and she said, can I get things, copies made? Principal said, yeah. She says, here's my agenda. So she had an agenda for her board meeting of associated little students in sixth grade. Principal said, I was totally dumbfounded. She said, I have never had a sixth grader bring me an agenda for her meeting. I said, oh, most definitely. She said, because normally I would put together two or three things on a piece of paper and pass it out at the meeting. So this young lady walks in with an agenda. And we laughed because I said, would you? She says, well, Mom, every time you go to a meeting,
right,
you have an agenda.
That's what she's heard.
Exactly. And she then took one of my agendas off my desk from some meeting and put down the things it had and that they need, old business, new business, whatever it was. But it was the funniest thing that she wrote her own agenda, typed it up, and took it to campus the next morning because she had a board meeting that day to get her principal to duplicate copies for her board. So she was a student body president. She became a speaker and, you know, very much because she followed me around.
Yeah.
Great speaker, does excellent presentations. And then went on to high school and became the valedictorian. She was one of those ninth graders I was talking to, became a valedictorian of her high school and won a number of awards, science awards, those kinds of things. Never had a job, always worked as an intern because of Park Treff's work.
Mm-hmm.
So she had great skills in research and lab work. And all of her life she's had some internship that has been beneficial to her.
So she was interested in science from early on?
Early on. She went to the Elementary Institute of Science, which is a great science program in the Southeast community, a little house where kids studied science, where, you know, she, they would go out in the canyon, find dead dogs and cats and bring them back and dissect them and, oh, Jesus, all kinds of crazy things. But she got into it. And I remember when she was in sixth grade, when she first went to Gompers, because Gompers was a 6th through 12th grade school focused on math and science. And I remember her going, her first trip to UCSD, they went to the morgue. And she came home, she said that was the best trip. She thoroughly enjoyed the morgue and all those kind of things. Her daddy had decided when she was little that she was going to be a doctor, because he at some point wanted to be a doctor and became a lawyer. But he decided that was the best profession, and he programmed her to be a doctor. He programmed her from day one to be a doctor. But she loved science. She loved math. I remember little things that were done, you know, as a kid who's a kid of color and a female, too, at the same time. I remember her coming home and says, you know, I'm not really good at math, Mom. This was when she's about third grade or whatever, third, fourth grade. I said, why? Well, I'm just not, you know, I'm not good at it. And I thought that was funny because I said, well, you don't have to be good. Just keep getting A's. She's okay. I mean, you know, it was one of those kind of things. So she's always gotten A's in math and science. But someone was telling her, girls don't do well in math. Girls don't do well in science. You should be a singer. You know, that kind of stuff. She couldn't sing a lick, you know. But I thought it was kind of funny. But she came home one day and told me, you know, I'm really not very good at math, Mom. And I go, oh, really? And I was, you know, this is a revelation to me. And I said, well, why do you? She said, I'm just not good at it. I just know I'm not. I said, well, you know, you keep getting A's. I know, but I'm not really good at it. I said, well, I tell you what. She said, what? As long as you keep getting A's, you don't have to be good at it, okay? She said, okay. I mean, third grade. She figured, fine, I'll get A's. I just won't be good at it. And so she proceeded to do her thing. But she graduated from high school with honors and, you know, was a student body president and all those kinds of things. One of the things she did was really quite remarkable in high school. And I understand they've never done it since. She decided when she was in 11th grade that she was going to put on a multicultural fair. I think she was the director at the high school of some kind of, I forgot what her position was, whether she was a program director on student government or something. And her teachers and her vice principal says, we could not have conceptualized this ourselves. This kid decided that instead of doing the typical food where you have some Mexican food, some Chinese, whatever, you know, these little food fairs, she actually did a whole day conference at her school.
Oh, wonderful.
She had over 75 workshops run by people in the various diverse communities, coordinated at her school. She had a reception for them before school. She had every teacher organized to go to certain places to hear different lectures at different times of the day. This kid had this spreadsheet that was amazing to me, had invited all these people, wrote letters to them. They showed up at the school. They did these workshops for kids. And then at the end of the day, they had this huge food festival. But she had workshops on Indians and Indian culture. She had workshops on Vietnamese culture, Jewish culture. You name it, she had tapped into 75 different kinds of workshops that was held at this school. I was amazed at 11th grader doing this. Her teacher was just dumb. I mean, her principal was dumbfounded. Yeah. And she did this for 2 years. They didn't do it again. They said it was, in fact, when she left, the teacher said they wouldn't do it because it was too much work.
Oh, yeah.
They didn't want to do it. But here was this high schooler, this ninth grader. So she's always been an organized person.
Yeah.
Very, very organized.
Yeah.
So when she went off to college, she went to Xavier University in New Orleans. And became obviously their program director and something else, won their volunteer award because she volunteered in schools, and then left Xavier and went to med school in Rochester, and currently just graduated last week in a residency program with OBGYN. Wanda, she's won a number of awards for research. She's very focused on community, much more than my son is, who's much more business. But she picks it up from me, obviously, because much of the work she did in med school had to do with women and health care for poor women and homeless women.
Right.
Did research on homeless women and the kinds of things that impact their lives. And then went with me to South Africa, where she had a chance to work in the clinics of South Africa and in the hospitals to see what was going on with women and AIDS and those kinds of things when we went on our first trip to South Africa. So she's always been very community-minded. Most recently, as she graduated from her residency, she won the research award because she's doing research on young women and their knowledge of this new this new virus, Pavlova virus or whatever it is, and whether or not poor kids are getting the information and getting the inoculation against this to prevent cervical cancer. So that's been her passion. She says in her life at some point she'll probably be a surgeon general. But now she's decided she's also going to do, because she's really interested in young people and loves surgery, so she's into adolescent gynecology. And she will be one of the few adolescent gynecologists in the nation. She's in a program that she'll be going to Cincinnati's Children's Hospital. So she's, and she'll get a master's in public health at the same time. So she is forever going to school. She's one, you know, and I'm amazed because I don't think I could study as much and as hard as she does all the time. But she can, and she doesn't mind it. And she, I was telling someone one time, when she was in undergraduate, she went to a fellowship program in the summer at Rochester, where she eventually decided to go to med school when she was in her sophomore year. And her principal at the time, who still follows her around, we went to see her presentation in this competition of all the students who were doing a fellowship, that internship that summer at Rochester Medical School from all the different colleges. And she got up and did this wonderful presentation, and it was funny. And at the end of it, of course, I didn't understand a word of it. I didn't understand the terminology. I didn't even know what we were talking about. And at the end, I asked her, "Do you really know what you talked about?" She said, "Of course." I said, "Then it must be wonderful." And I asked the doctor that. I said, "Was it good?" She said, "It was great." I said, "Wonderful." I mean, I knew the oral part. I knew she made good presents, but to know exactly, I have no idea. She's also done research on women who've been raped, and she won an award at the National Medical Convention in her first year of med school, her first year of residency, rather, where she looked at whether or not the hospitals in the Illinois actually give women everything they're supposed to get when they've been raped. Do they actually follow all of the protocol? And she discovered that the vast majority of them don't. You know, like 60-70% of them do not actually care for women as they should who've been raped. You know, do they give them the HIV test? Do they tell them about counseling? You know, she said there's a protocol that they're supposed to follow. And I think it was 70-80% of them do not follow protocol. So she did research in all the hospitals in Illinois and as an advocate for women as to, you know, what is going on. Most of the OBGYNs are males who are doing, most of the people who are doing that are looking at it differently than a woman and who's been abused and not really caring for her and being able to make sure that all of the things are done that should be done. And it's kind of shocking that it's not happening today after so many years of concern about women and sexual assault, that it's still not happening. So Akilah's kind of one of these, you know, doctor who's a strong advocate for the poor, for women, for people who are traditionally not being served well. And she recognizes that the medical profession is very, very biased. I remember one of her greatest revelations and concern was when there was a 27-year-old woman who had been given a complete hysterectomy at 27. And all the woman had was she had some cancer on her cervix that could have simply been scraped off and cauterized, but yet they gave her the most extreme procedure, which was a total hysterectomy at 27. And when she inquired of that, the person who did it said, couldn't explain why they did it, and in the end said, well, she already has 3 kids. So we're doing social engineering at this point. And so she was very concerned about that. So she said, you know, women need information. People who are poor, people of color need good health care. She also realized, it was funny to me when she was in med school, she said, I realized how paranoid black people are of the medical profession, she said, and the need for doctors because, you know, given the Tuskegee experiment
Absolutely.
And all those kinds of things. She said when she was a med student, she said she'd be in there with the doctor who's doing this wonderful stuff and giving this person that advice. And then the doctor would turn, the patient would turn to her, little girl, what do you think? Because she's the African-American, and this is an African-American patient. They don't give a care what this white doctor's telling them. They, after he's told them all this, you need to do that,
right?
They would stop. And they look, then they say, the patient would turn to her. And she said, I'm like a med student. I'm sitting here, you know, I'm learning. And they go, little girl, what do you think about this? And she said, she'd have to think like, oh, yeah, that's a good thing to do. But she was being so confident. She said, to herself, he's the doctor. I'm not the doctor yet. But they trusted her
right.
opinion about what was going on.
Right.
So that was very important for her. But my daughter continues. She's a scientist. She's married now. She just married a year ago to an engineer. And she's from Chicago on her way to Cincinnati for the next phase of her life. Her goal, obviously, is to eventually return to San Diego. That's what she says. She wants to be near her mommy.
Isn't that
so we will
great.
See. But she's a great kid. Took me on a cruise. I told someone I knew I had arrived when, you know, you're constantly caring for your kids. When I went to Chicago one time, and we were getting ready, and she was in her residency and, you know, making some money, and she said she was going to the grocery store, and I was at a visit, and I go, okay, here we go again. I bought groceries in every apartment she's ever lived in since freshman year. And so she says, come go with me. I said, I don't know. Oh, no, come go with me. I said, okay, here we go. So I go to the grocery store with her, and we go through this process, get groceries, and then she gets to the end of the line, and she's going through her purse, kind of fumbling, looking for her wallet. And I said, you need something? You need any help? Anything? No. I said, oh, okay. So I stood there, and she swiped her thing, and we went on out the store. So I said, you didn't need anything? She said, no. She says, did you think I brought you to the store so you could buy my groceries? I said, well, I have in the past. She goes, oh, Mom. I wouldn't do it. I mean, you know, and I told someone, I think I have died and gone to heaven to visit a kid who buys her own groceries and feeds me. And then this year, she took me on this cruise for Mother's Day, so I knew I had died and gone to heaven.
Yeah.
You know, those kind of things. So I said, well, you know, I guess if you live long enough, I was telling a faculty member the other day who's struggling with his 12-year-old and 10-year-old and a 14-year-old with attitude, I said, the key is to live long enough. That's the key. Don't die now. Whatever you do, do not die now, because you have to live long enough for them to buy you something of significance, take you somewhere you want to go, and then for them to have children so they can see what it was like to be a parent. I said, so you just got to hang in here and stay alive. That's all you got to do. So it was kind of funny, but she's a good kid. My son is totally different than my daughter. My son is...
Now, his name is...
His name is Akil Kalfani. And Akil is the male part of Akilah. Akil also means intelligent. Kalfani means destined to rule. And my son, when he was born, was a big kid. He was like 8 pounds, some odd ounces. But he's been tall all of his life. He was as tall as his second grade teacher. Okay? And now, she wasn't a real tall woman, but he's been big. He's the kind of kid, he's been a teddy bear his whole life. Really tall kid. I mean, he's 6'7", 6'8", now, okay? 6'7", or 6'8". He's a tall kid. And but it's funny, he was always this independent spirit. He's always been a kind of laid-back kid. You know, my daughter was like the neurotic one that says, hurry up, Mom, we got to get to school because I'll be late. We got to be late. You know, I don't want to be late. You know, and my son is chilling in the back seat. He says to her, what are you worried about? We're with Mama. What can they do? Tell our mother? So when you think about it, that is so true. I mean, yeah. He can't get in trouble because I'm the one bringing him to school late.
Yeah.
And so he always had this laid-back attitude, indifferent toward everything. This is a kid who barely graduates from high school until he decides he wants to graduate. He does well when he wants to. Mm-hmm. He decides he's not sure if college is for him. It was funny because he was in an algebra class, and he didn't do well the first semester because he really didn't want to do algebra. Geometry, I guess it was. Second semester, we said, okay, I tell you what, you don't do well in geometry, you can't get a driver's license because no idiot should ever be on the streets driving at any point. So that semester, he gets A in geometry. Mm. The teacher is furious because she says no one takes geometry 2 and get an A who didn't get at least a B in geometry 1. I think he got a D in geometry 1. And he gets an A in geometry 2, you know, because he didn't want to do it. He was totally bored with school. School didn't have a relevance to him. He didn't have an interest in it, totally bored. So he went to school, you know, because we made him go. He didn't get in trouble. He wasn't a bad kid or anything like that. He was just the minimum. And so we would, you know, we'd take things from him, which was always interesting. He would always take kids out to the garage, open up the trunk of his dad's car and say, see, I have a PlayStation. I have all these things in the trunk of his dad's car because he had lost all his privileges. His room would be bare until he finished his work. But he'd rebound, do his work somewhat and go on. So he went off to school for a while. He didn't like it very much, came home and then went to school here. And then he decided he didn't want to go to school. And my position is, you know, college is not for everyone. If it's for you, it'll be there. So at that point, he decided he was going to go into real estate, and he did. He became a real estate, got past his real estate license, you know, the whole bit. But then, more recently, he decided he was going to go to college, which is really at 26, he's decided to go back to school. And is doing extremely well. I think he's a 4.0. It's amazing. He's knocking out like 35, 40 credits this one semester. And what motivated him to go to school was really quite interesting was his sister. Because, see, my son is really into the business and politics, although now he's highly motivated on Obama. And I think what happened in his case is that he sees, my God, he says, Mom, this guy went to Harvard, Yale. He's still cool. He walks like a brother. He can do the handshake like a brother. He's smart. He's brilliant. And so he's like become his role model in some sense.
That's wonderful.
It's wonderful. I mean, he's motivated. He gets up every morning and reads it and listens to, he reads the newspaper now and listens to CNN. I told him, I said, your dad would be shocked to know that you're doing CNN because you wouldn't even look at the news with him. But it was funny, his sister, who decided she's going to, he's decided his sister's going to be very famous and very wealthy. My son has decided that. So she says to him that she wants to open a bunch of clinics for kids and stuff like that, and the stuff that she's doing and working with families. And so he says, well, God, Akilah, we could be partners. You know, he's really into business, real estate. I could help do this and do that for you. And she says, you really can't because you don't have a degree. And I would never turn my money over to someone who's not well prepared. He decides to go to school. So he has a plan now. He says, now I know what I want to do. I want to run, you know. So now he knows what he wants to do. So he has a plan. So I said, fine. So he's back in school. Fortunately, he doesn't have, and I told him, you know, you're very fortunate in some sense. And he recognizes that he doesn't have children. He doesn't have a lot of drama. He doesn't have those things in his life. He doesn't have a prison record, all those kinds of things. He's just a kid who is going through different things. He also, however, was delayed significantly because in 2001, he had cancer. And that was a traumatic experience of my life. In 2001, he was in school. He fell and broke his, he fell and injured himself initially. And so he went through this process of his, I think was a peroneal nerve or whatever it was, snapped. And so he injured his leg. They had to do surgery. He had to do 2 surgeries starting in May. It went all the way to October, almost November. And he had 1 surgery here, then went to UCLA and had to have another surgery done to lift his foot so that he walks with, had a slight limp. So this is a kid who's always been athletic and everything, all of a sudden has this happen. Then as he's coming out of the final surgery and we're just about ready to take off the cast, he develops a lump on his I think on his throat. And we think it's a cold, it's a flu, it's this or that, and discovered it's lymphoma.
Whoa.
Exactly. So we go through a process with lymphoma. And the day he gets his cast off is right before Thanksgiving. He gets his cast off on that Monday, Tuesday, before Thanksgiving. And Wednesday he goes and takes his first chemo. So here's a 20-year-old kid with lymphoma. And he was in school. He was in school. And he was out of school now, obviously, with the leg and now with lymphoma, with the chemo treatments. In the process of all this, my husband becomes ill. And my husband and I had separated by then, and we'd been separated maybe less than a year. He ends up with a very rare cancer. We didn't know he had multiple myeloma initially. We didn't know what it was he had, but he had this amyloidosis. He was having difficulty breathing. Mm. And I realized he and I were caring for my son, and I realized, oh my God, he's dying. I'm looking at this because my daughter has said to me, Dad has something that if he has what I think he has, Mom, it's not going to be long. And he didn't want to tell me. Mm. He didn't want to tell my son. He didn't want to tell any of us. He thought he was going to have a heart transplant, all kinds of things. And this was a man who'd been very healthy, very conscious of his health. And so here I have my son in chemo, and then they tell me he has a 20% chance to live with the chemo. We're looking at doing stem cell transplant. Okay. And I've got that going on. At the same time, I've got my husband who is pretending to be well but is very ill and eventually goes into the hospital in March and basically comes out a month later but then goes back in and dies in June.
What year was this?
This was in 2002 when all this is happening in my life. And my son, he's given 20% chance unless he has a stem cell. A stem cell has to have a match by it has to be a sibling. He only has one sibling, his sister. She turns out to be a perfect match. But then he decides he doesn't want to do that. He decides he doesn't want to do stem cell. And we're devastated that he doesn't want to do it. But we'd gone to UCLA for different tests, and they had recommended different kinds of things and what have you. And because we tried to do stem cell with him. But by then he'd had so much chemo that his stem cell was destroyed. And nobody told us that maybe he should have his stem cell harvested before he had a lot of chemo. They don't tell you that, okay? Because that's an expensive process. So by the time he goes a whole lot of chemo that they don't think is working, we go through stem cells for several days up at City of Hope, and that doesn't work, trying to harvest stem cells. So then we bring in a sister who gets tested. And by this time, my husband is in intensive care. Then he's in definitive care, and he stays in the hospital as he's dying and struggling with it. Yeah. And the week before he dies, though, I'd gone to UCLA for a second opinion, and they had said basically everything we was doing was what we needed to do for my son. It was at that point that they said, but have a PET scan done, because a PET scan is something different. So Kaiser said, okay, we'll do a PET scan, no big deal. PET scan gets into the, because he had a mass in his chest, gets into the mass in his chest to see if whether there is anything, any cancer in that mass. So we go through this process, and I think the week before his father decided to stop all the treatments on him and to really die, we discovered my son was cancer-free. After all this stuff, we don't know why, just cancer-free. Mm. And so the doctor said, well, we won't do any more chemo. We'll just wait, because he hadn't had chemo in a couple of months. We said, we'll wait and see. So he went through this process. And then, of course, his dad dies that week. Mm. And he decides that he'd had enough, and he had them to stop the treatment, and he passes away in 2002.
Oh, boy.
And but now my son has been cancer-free since then. He never had another treatment. He's had no relapse, nothing. He has gone through it, and he's well. So it's been over 6 years.
Wonderful.
It's been over 6 years. And after 5 years, supposedly you're cured. So we went through this traumatic experience. But, like I told my son, and it was interesting, because I remember my mother talked about the open hand philosophy. And I don't know how I made it through the process, because I was chairing the department.
I was chairing
the department. I was on a zillion boards that I eventually got off of. I was doing all these things. I was president of the National Council for Black Studies. I'd just become president. I was running a national conference here at the time. My husband was sick. All these things were happening. But I had surrounding me the most wonderful people in my students and my colleagues, former students, people who just did things, who made sure things took place, yeah. you know, that took happen. I my sisters and my brothers, in fact, my kids, being raised in San Diego, not in Los Angeles, with their other nieces and nephews, had good relationships with their relatives, but had no, had didn't have the depth of relationship that they had until my son became ill. Mm-hmm. When my son became ill, his cousins in L.A., one of his cousins in particular, several of them came down for his first chemo treatment mm-hmm. to sit in the chemo room with him.
Wow.
One cousin said, told the people, she worked for the county of Los Angeles, she said, I'm going to be taking a vacation day every day that my cousin is in chemo. And mm-hmm. she has two kids. She made a commitment to come to San Diego to basically be at his chemo treatment every time he had chemo.
Yeah.
When I was at City of Hope, and I had to leave City of Hope because it was graduation, and my son, they were trying to harvest the stem cell for my son and one thing or another. And I had to leave, and my daughter hadn't gotten here because she was still in med school, and she wasn't coming in for another week or so. My sister and my niece, who does a chemo thing with him, she took off work, and they came and stayed with him at City of Hope to care for him while he was at City of Hope. So he was always surrounded by his aunts and his uncles and his cousins who cared for him and who were always there for him. And that really created such a bond for him with his cousins. I mean, even to this day, sure. they're just, it, I mean, it was a tremendous bond. He recognized the depth of our family. I knew it was there, and I knew they would always be there. But he didn't know it because we'd never been in crisis. We never had to really rely upon the family.
Yeah.
We're fairly self-contained financially and otherwise. But he saw the value of our family, the strength of our family, the strength of our cousins, his cousins, and those who were there for him through the illness, through all the different difficulty he had with the various surgeries. They were there for him. Then when he went through chemo, they were there for him again. And so it really strengthened his bond and his respect for his cousins, his aunts, his uncles, all those individuals. There's nothing they couldn't ask Akil to do that he would not do because he feels that close to them as a family. So he went through that, and coming out of it, you know, it was a coming out period for him of finding one himself, but also a sense of urgency that if you're going to enjoy life, enjoy it now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of that was why he said, I don't think I'm going to do school. And I said, okay, you've had a different experience in life. And I knew at some point he'd eventually come back to school,
yeah.
you know. But but he needed to, you know, not knowing for 5 years if you're going to, this thing's going to raise his ugly head again.
Oh.
You want to live life. You want to enjoy it. You want to go to New York. You want to do those kinds of things that are fun. You want to go to the Laker games. You know, you want to do those things that, you know, that you shouldn't do, that you can't afford, but you do them anyway because life is short. And so his view of the world is sometimes shorter than my daughter's, who has a long view, and he has a shorter view
mm-hmm.
that you do things now because you have to do them because you don't know what's going to happen.
Right.
And she can plan her life for 20 years in advance. He plans for what's going to happen now, how he's going to live, and what
That's
he's going to do,
yeah.
and those kinds of
I
things.
Understand.
Yeah, totally different perspective. But I have two great kids. I mean, my kids are wonderful to the extent they don't give me a whole lot of drama. You know, they take very good care of me. My daughter is probably much more neurotic than my son. She calls me in the most remote areas of Africa. When we're in South Africa, it was funny, this year we're in South Africa, and I bought a calling card in case I needed to call somebody. Everybody that night was trying to call their relatives to say they landed in Cape Town, blah, 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 blah. And somebody, I said, well, you guys can use my card. They said, oh, you might need us. I probably won't, you know, that's why. I said, Keela's going to call. And we were having dinner, and I paid attention, so sure enough, as soon as I went upstairs, the light is blinking. Mom, are you in Cape Town? Have you arrived yet? She's going to find me. So eventually, I'll call you back later. So sure enough, by 3 in the morning, she wakes me up, you know, with a call. She's calling to make sure I land in Cape Town. And then when I get to Johannesburg, sure, like clockwork, come 2 o'clock in the morning or whenever, because she has my itinerary.
Mm-hmm.
And it was funny, when I landed in D.C., she called me, okay? Then when I landed in San Diego, because I could see my house from the plane, and I saw my son's truck sitting in the driveway, knowing he hadn't gotten to come. I called him to say, Akil, we just landed. Come get me, okay? And as soon as I hung up the phone, the special ring went off, and it was Akila. I said, oh, Akila, I said, we just landed in San Diego. We haven't got to the gate yet, da-da-da. She says, I know. I saw it on the Internet. So this kid... tracks me down. I mean, she knows everywhere I am, and whenever I travel, I send her the itinerary, because it's, if I don't, I'm going to get grief when I wherever she is.
What a wonderful bond.
Yeah. Well, as soon as I land, it was funny, when I went to Florida to speak last year, as soon as I landed, I didn't call her because I was in the midst of getting luggage, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I had a driver who was picking me up, and me and this other woman. So by the time I get into this car, the phone goes off. It's Akilah. Why didn't you call? You've already landed. Okay, I'm here. Life is cool. So and so on. So we go on, and the people in the van are kind of laughing because I said, it's my daughter. I know it's her. And on the when I stayed, that was that Friday night. That Saturday, that Sunday morning, as I'm getting back on in the same van with these people to go to the airport, the phone goes off again. Everybody goes, that's your daughter. I said, exactly. Where are you now? I'm on my way to the airport. Well, call me before you get on the plane. Will do. So she's very, and so Akilah's like, my son is like, I don't call you, Mom, because I know Akilah got it covered, and she's going to let me know where you are anyway and what's going on. So she's going to, and when everybody's like, oh, I don't know if I'm going to get a call, I said, girl, that's the last thing I'm worried about. Akilah is going to find her mother no matter what, where, when. She's going, she went off to school in 1966. She has called me every day since then, if not 3-4 times a day. Hmm. So when people says to me, I haven't talked to my daughter in months, I'm wondering, who are these people?
Yeah.
You know? And they said, well, I haven't talked to my daughter in 3 months. I said, child, I talk to my child 3 times a day because Akilah is going to call me. I mean, and that's fine. I mean, that's wonderful. I mean, we have a very close relationship because, you know, they were my kids who went everywhere with me, who went into all the meetings, and they talk about now their life in the back of the room, playing on the floor with each other while I'm conducting business or doing what I have to do because, I believe, you know, wherever I go, they can go, and they can come go with me. And I tell people, you know, if you need me to come, I got to bring my kids. They say, fine. You know, they're well-behaved. They know how to go to meetings. They know how to stay in meetings. They know how to be quiet, those kinds of things. And so, but they were very much a part of my life and still are a part of my life in terms of direction and where I go. They're very protective of me, and I'm very protective of them in their life. And we have a wonderful relationship. Like I said, my son is a great kid. He's here in San Diego, and he's in and out of my house all the time, barbecuing, taking care of the house. When I leave, he says he's my super shuttle. He drives me to the airport back and forth and does that kind of thing. And so, and they seek advice from me too. I mean, that's one thing. I don't want to run their lives, and I respect the decisions that they make, but they seldom make a decision without calling me.
Yeah.
And say, Mom, what do you think about this?
Yeah.
And because I'm going to tell them, you know, what I think very honestly, and then I'm leave it at that.
Mm-hmm.
But I always say in the end, you have to make that decision. You're an
right.
adult. And I want my kids to be very independent. Even though we have a close relationship, it is important to me that they are very independent of me.
Right.
You know, and those kinds of things. So.
Right.
And with that.
All right. Okay. Would you like me to turn it on?
Yeah, why don't we do that then?
Okay.
You know, one of the things that always continued with me, even with my involvement in my with my children, and all those things have a tendency to kind of weave themselves together. I continue to remain professionally involved as I was involved in the community, and tried to relate always my community involvement to my profession itself. When I began here at San Diego State, I was very involved in the Speech Association because I had never really planned to be in Black Studies when I came here. I mean, as my career early on in grad school, I was a speech person. So naturally, my initial involvements were with the Speech Association. But once again, I was always trying to figure out how I could take this association and make it relevant to opportunities for African Americans, opportunities for others. And so I regularly attended those associations, but immediately became president of the Black Caucus and worked in that caucus for 6 years as the leader of the caucus. And then developed from that a National Communications Association, which became a Black organization of professionals that did conferences. We did conferences in Kenya. We did conferences in Barbados. In fact, Ruby Dee and Ossie Davis went with us to Barbados and during the conference and spent the week with us as we talked about issues affecting African-American professionals in the field of communication and the theories and concepts of communication and what those different theories were and how they related to us as professionals. But one of the things I learned when I had two kids was that it became impossible to be in two careers. I couldn't be in speech and Black studies at the same time. The demands were too great, too many different organizations. I couldn't go to every conference at every group. I couldn't focus as much on speech as I wanted to. And yet I realized that what was needed for me for to focus in Black studies. And so I immediately began to take my energies and my professionalism and focus in the National Council for Black Studies. When I became a member of the National Council, it was a struggling organization. I had been a member before, but when I really became active in it in the late 1990s, it was a struggling organization that had been in existence for many years but had never really gained the prominence that it should in the profession because, like so many other organizations, people had used it to get what they wanted. They used it to get tenure. They used it to get where they were going, but they didn't want to invest the kind of time and energy in the development of the organization. So I became the secretary of it because a friend of mine, who's now deceased, Bill Little, wanted me to be involved. He said, you know, you've developed this great program in San Diego. You've done the stuff regionally, and you do a lot of stuff. You know, we need your expertise, your leadership at this level. So he hooked me into being secretary of it because our secretary was a former a leader, an anti-apartheid leader in South Africa. And once Mandela came back into power in the mid-1990s, he was brought back to South Africa to be in charge of educational programs. Cato was his name. And so as a result, I took over Cato's position as secretary and then became vice president and eventually president. I set for the organization, I think, some goals that it needed to have, and those goals were that, one, we needed to have conferences annually that were significant, because before they were hit and miss conferences. And so in 2002, when I was going through all this drama, we took on the national conference in San Diego. And whenever I had a conference in San Diego that was like the National Council for Black Studies, in the past, they'd have maybe 150 people at the conference. San Diego, we had close to 500 people at our conference. In 1 year, we went to 500 people. Because in addition to dealing with the university, we also dealt with the community college, and we dealt with K-12. I brought in teachers to say, hey, you need to know about Black studies. And so they married their conference with ours, and we had this great conference that was from kindergarten through post-secondary, focused on African-American studies. We also did the same thing in 2000, and they were here in San Diego in 2007. And once again, huge conference that had that brought in K-12 into the conference with the National Council for Black Studies. We also ran a separate institute that, like the academy, we then had a special institute for teachers that brought all the scholars in to educate teachers on how to use Black material in your classroom, how to incorporate in your literature, in your social studies, in your history classes. And so teachers got a free institute that the National Council paid for through that. So as president of the National Council, I end up actually working to stabilize the organization, institute its journal, because I had been on the Western Journal of Black Studies editorial board. So then we basically stabilized the International Journal of Africana Studies so that now it's a reputable journal that's really well respected around the world. And our national conference, national officers are actually focused on promoting the discipline. We now have a tremendous number of our students. We started taking students from San Diego State to the National Council for Black Studies to help them to network with other students, but also to network professionals. So now we have students who are attending schools in Black Studies at Cornell, attending school at Ohio State. We've got students at Temple University getting their master's, and now at Berkeley, getting their master's and doctorates in Black Studies because we've been able to network through the National Council for Black Studies as president of the association to stabilize the organization. I continue to serve on the executive board of the National Council as the past president, and we just received $250,000 grant from Ford Foundation to work on the infrastructure of the organization. Because I'm an organization person, I believe very strongly that an organization is essential for any group of people to be strong, to move forward, whether it's a profession or whether it's our community. So I continue to work with the National Council, and I'm being asked now to be pulled back into the Speech Association, so I may attend their conference this year, now that I don't have little kids pulling at my ankle or wanting my attention in terms of my children. But I focus my involvement on National Council because of the need that's there. You know, my life has, as I try to sum up, you know, who is Shirley Weber and how does she get to where she is in terms of moving in into areas, coming out of the projects of Los Angeles, out of the country of Hope, Arkansas. and finding myself in a situation where I've, you know, worked with presidents and presidents' wives and served on national commissions and boards locally and interaction in an international sense with the embassies in South Africa and working with Peace Corps in Ghana and, you know, adopting schools around the world and those kinds of things. I think, you know, it emanates from, as I said, my mother's philosophy about open hand, my daddy's philosophy about no love lost. He had this thing that told us always to do whatever we had to do, and if people were angry with us or if people tried to hurt us, keep in mind that anyone who did that didn't love you anyway, and that if you lose that friend, there was no love lost, he said, because they didn't love you in the first place, because people who love you don't hurt you. That your name is your bond, that you keep a good name, and a good name can take you anywhere in the world. And I've always respected that aspect, that people on campus who may agree with me or disagree, oftentimes I get a call from different presidents of the campus over the years who would ask me for my honest opinion on something, because they knew that no matter what, Shirley was going to tell them the truth, whether they liked it or not. And it was not an offensive thing, but it's one that I believe very strongly that I had to tell the truth. But I can remember when I was a kid, living in the projects, or living really in Los Angeles as we moved from the projects, and I was walking to school one day, and I could see this as vividly as if it were yesterday. It was on Vernon and Hooper. There was a storefront, and on the street, and this storefront, I don't even know what was behind the storefront, but there was this big picture of Africa. And as a kid, you know, I never thought of ever going to Africa, never thought of my relationship to Africa and my heritage, but obviously it was in me. I looked at this sign, and it had this sign. It says, "Never forget from whence we've come." And I remember that sign to this day, "Never forget from whence we've come." And I just said, every day I walk by the sign, and here I am, you know, 40 years later, still see, remembering this sign that I saw when I was like 14, 15 years old. And I always wondered, wow, that was what the sign meant. And then as I got older, it was still in me. And I think my whole life has been that I have been given wonderful things, great parents, strong families, that have been able to overcome tremendous obstacles in life, whether it was poverty, whether it was not having access to all the educational things that you want, but yet having a strong faith in God, a strong church, a strong family, a strong community, that I had, and that it was so in me that I could never forget from whence I've come. I could never forget all of the individuals who had done so much for me over the years. I remember I was in a speech contest I won reading Frederick Douglass' speech. And Frederick Douglass said, "If I forget thee, O Jerusalem, if I forget the bleeding children of sorrow, then may my right hand forget her cunning, and may my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth." I remember memorizing that to do a speech. Then I was in a contest when I was in 10th grade. And I felt very strongly that Frederick Douglass understood that he had a responsibility to continue to remember those who were the bleeding children of sorrow, and that Maya Angelou has said that you represent the hope and the dream of the slave, that through it all, you know, that that you have a responsibility. And I take my personal responsibility, my professional responsibility very seriously, that every day I breathe is a blessing from God, and that I have to give that blessing to somebody else. And that if anything I can do to make the world better, because I believe that I can, through the things that have been given to me, through the spirit that I have, that wherever I go, it has to change. And I never want to forget from whence I've come.
Thank you. This has been just such a wonderful experience, sitting here with you while you shared your life journey and your philosophy. And I'm sure that others will be enjoying listening to this in the future.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I feel very honored.
Thank you. I do too.